Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
For Wednesday, March 15th, 1995. This is Hard Copy.
I'm Terry Murphy in downtown Los Angeles at the O.J. Simpson trial, where Detective Mark Furman is developing his own fan club. Like two gladiators doing battle, Detective Mark Furman and attorney F. Lee Bailey squared off again in court in the O.J. Simpson case. And as Doug Bruckner reports, the detective appears to be winning over the hearts of many women.
Cato star rose months ago, but Mark Furman's has just taken off. And has it ever. Today was the third day of Furman's cross-examination, and by most accounts, the embattled detective has stood up to the challenge posed by famed defense attorney F. Lee Bailey. The detective's good looks and cool demeanor in court have made him a sex symbol to a lot of people who have put aside their soap operas to follow the Simpson case.
He has a certain innocence about him, which I think has an appeal also.
Furman's also coming out ahead in a hard copy poll. We ask, who's winning, Bailey or Furman? And the detective won, hands down. More than 30,000 of you called, and 86% cast their vote for the embattled detective.
Mark Furman was intelligent, good-looking, articulate police officer who presented himself as being able to assess what was happening in this case, presenting evidence in this case in a way that was rational and thoughtful. That's how he first came off.
And you say on your oath that you have not addressed any black person as a or spoken about black people as in the past 10 years, Detective Furman.
That's what I'm saying, sir.
As the trial went on and as we learned more information about Furman, that veneer kind of came off. F. Lee Bailey destroyed Mark Furman on the stand. You know, he did more than back him in the corner. He backed him into a corner and then, like, crushed him.
There was discussion and somewhat of meeting of minds and hoping that we could prepare me for cross-examination. I don't think it achieved those goals.
But you said, Detective Furman, that your concerns had nothing to do with the crime scene or the murder. There was something else.
Yes.
All right. What were the concerns, Detective Furman?
Well, there's been numerous motions to bring in irrelevant evidence into this trial.
Irrelevant evidence?
Yes, sir.
Such as? Detective Furman, what events did you have in mind when you spoke of irrelevant occurrences that you feared might be brought into court?
Kathleen Bell.
All right. And you say that that's irrelevant?
Yes.
He's a very arrogant individual. He's very self-absorbed.
Bailey has a way of putting it out there that sounded so strong, and Furman just went right along with it.
It was just another knife to pull. It was another excuse, another arrow in the quiver that they could pull when somebody is as guilty as sin. They can pull the race card, and then somehow you're 50% home.
As week 8 unfolds with the prosecution's star witness, Detective Mark Furman, the defense is biding its time. They've made no secret of their plan to attack Furman as a racist who planted evidence. But the fury and thunder of legal legend F. Lee Bailey and his cross-examination of Furman raises the bar on how to trap a witness in a lie.
There are some issues we need to resolve before he gets the witness stand in front of the jury.
How many total times have you met with either Mr. Darden, Ms. Clark, or anyone else in the prosecution team in connection with your testimony?
7 or 8 times.
7 or 8. Beginning when and ending when?
It'll be various times this year.
Do you represent to this court and jury that 3 lawyers asked you a total of 10 questions?
Yes.
In this session?
Yes.
Do you know any lawyer on this earth who is capable of asking only 3 questions?
Not currently.
Touche. Now, do you have any memory of even one of these 10 questions? Not a single one?
No, sir.
And this happened when, Detective Furman?
I believe it was 2 or 3 weeks ago.
2 or 3 weeks ago?
Yes.
Well, now, you have been exhibiting a startling memory for detail of a crime that was 8 months ago, have you not?
Sustained.
Many people don't understand how lonely it was sitting up there knowing what was about to come.
It's questionable whether it was necessary for Mark Furman to testify. Prosecution said they had to introduce him, they had to bring him on because he found the glove behind Kate O'Kalin's room on the Rockingham estate. But many experts in trial law say that other, you know, the person who collected the evidence could have testified, that other people could have testified. So obviously, in hindsight, it was a really bad choice.
Tell us, please, what it was you offered these lawyers in that room about your vocabulary, Detective Furman.
Effley Bailey's cross-examination of Mark Furman was very dramatic. It was kind of like out of a movie. And it was a big moment in the courtroom because we knew that it was pivotal. Like, the way that Effley Bailey was setting him up just seemed so like such a classic trap. And it was almost hard to believe, like, is he really just going to walk into this trap like that? But he did.
I don't use any type of language to describe people of any race, such as what is alleged by Kathleen Bell.
I also became a little angry and a little stubborn, and it's almost like Effley Bailey and I were there all by ourselves.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's day, Thursday, February 4th, 2021, Black History Month. So I have been told this is our 11th study session on Jeffrey Toobin, Zoom Bomber number one of 2020. Jeffrey Toobin's bestseller, The Run of His Life, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. So we are picking up in the middle of Chapter 17. This is right after the repartee about the size of Effley Bailey's penis, where we're really about to get to the nitty-gritty, have you said nigger, and talking about any black people, Chapter 17, midpoint. The audio segments that we heard at the beginning. So we heard a little bit hard copy, which is kind of like a tabloid television show that came on in the 90s. Might still come on. But you heard the date, March 15, 1995. They were talking about the Furman trial. I thought that was so important because until those audio tapes came out, and those audio tapes didn't come out until I believe August, maybe even September, by the time that they were actually played in court. So we're talking almost a half year from when he testified the first time, when those audio tapes came, way down the road. But before those tapes, you heard lots of people said they believed Mark Furman. I believed him, thought he was telling the truth. Police officials, oh, we stand by him. This is absurd, smearing this guy. And in addition, not only do we think he's not racist and old Effley Bailey in there bullying Mark Furman, treating him all bad, how many people come out? Not only is Mark Furman not a racist, that is a good-looking white man. Did you hear how many people they said that in the hard copy? That, wow, he is a new sex heartthrob. A sex symbol, that Mark Furman, that is a good looking white man. Wow. And it just continues. I've heard that over and over. We started with the hard copy segment and then it transitioned. We went to the Court TV 25-year special segment and it continued. I've heard white people, non-white people. Wow. I don't know if that Mark Furman planted a glove or not, but that is a good looking white man. The system of racism, white supremacy. Mr. Fuller says, racist man, racist woman, they are the most attractive people in the known universe. He didn't mean physical looks, but my goodness, they do say race soldiers. Wow. The beauty con game. Isn't that what Pam said? The beauty con game. Mark Furman. Then they continue deception. That's the main thing about the system of white supremacy, deception. Jeffrey Toobin has told so many lies in this book, and there's so many more to come. And for me, that just further, if I thought O.J. Simpson, if I was maybe thinking maybe he was guilty or I was resistant, you know, y'all saying he didn't do this and all that. The fact that you just keep seeing flagrant lies from the people who say, oh, yeah, he did it. Arunthal James killed that white woman. Arunthal James killed Ron Goldman, too. He killed them both. Stabbed those people up. It's a disgrace. Played the race card and fouled up old Mark Furman. Blamed it on him so that he could get off with it. If I thought that way, I would have to really pause, maybe even reconsider, just like, why are Jeff Toobin and these folks having to lie? Like, if he did it, you just put the information out. Now, last week, he said, talking about the prosecution, Marsha Clark, Chris Darden, that their prosecution amounted to about a half an hour of Furman fielding questions while he ate a sandwich. Now, you just heard a lot of segments from the trial. You didn't hear journalists, newscasters offering their opinion. You heard F. Lee Bailey talking in the courtroom and saying, wait a minute, we need to examine this. So I keep saying, just get the trial transcript or watch the trial, because so many people lie, especially the people that want to insist that O.J. Simpson is guilty. They lie and lie and lie. The evidence is not on their side. And so F. Lee Bailey, you heard him in the courtroom saying, man, this guy Furman, what do you mean that they had to spend all these special hours mollycoddling? That was the special verb, in fact, that Marsha Clark uses in her book, Without a Doubt. She's pissed that we got a mollycoddle. I had to look that one. I don't even know what that means, that we got to spend all this special time with Mark Furman and we got to go over and rehearse how he's going to respond. That, you know, they're going to ask you if you've called him a nigger. Did you call him a coon? Did you call him a spear chucker? You sure you didn't call him a coon? Never? Not once? Silverback? You don't do that? Ape? No. We got to do it. F. Lee Bayless says, what do you mean? We got to spend all this time mollycoddling a witness to make sure that he can get on stand and speak correctly and be in control of himself. You heard him questioning Mark Furman. How many times did you have to meet with him? 6 or 7 times? That seems like it would have amounted to more than 30 minutes, right? Again, this is in the trial. This is not something that's hidden. You can watch this on YouTube. How many times did you have to meet with him? 6 or 7 times. What were you all going over? You don't remember any of these questions. Wow, that's so interesting. We will go ahead and get started again. We are still in the middle of the cross-examination and in the archives. F. Lee Bailey, you can go back and hear what he had to say about all this just about 30 days ago. And I guess before we start, just to remind folks, Mark Furman took the stand approximately 3 weeks before the Oklahoma City bombing, April 1995. Mark Furman was on the stand about 3 weeks before that happened. What do they have to do with each other? Timothy McVeigh, Mark Furman, both veterans, evidence that both of these white men seem to dislike black males engaged in some sort of sexual activity with white women, both with ties to the Idaho State area, both with ties to Nazi, white supremacist, racist propaganda paraphernalia. Perhaps 2 different forms of domestic terrorism. Keep that, I guess you can put that in context with the recent talk about veterans, military personnel, and their participation at the siege. Timothy McVeigh, Mark Furman, Capital Siege. Context of white supremacy. Jeffrey Toobin, the run of his life. Audio segment 1.
Bailey had failed to budge Furman on his story about his role in the investigation. All he wanted now was to leave the sound of the word nigger ringing in the ears of the jurors. Bailey knew better than most lawyers the power that word exerted over a jury, especially one that included African Americans. When Bailey had defended himself against fraud charges in Florida in 1973, the government's first witness in the trial was a man named Jimmy James, a former executive at Glenn Turner's Coscott Interplanetary Company. James testified that the operation was little more than a Ponzi scheme. Though all of Bailey's fellow defendants were white, Bailey knew a surefire way to inject race into the case. During his cross-examination of James, Bailey asked him if he had ever said, "I hate niggers." James denied it. Recalling the scene in his book, For the Defense, Bailey wrote that the atmosphere in the courtroom changed noticeably when I used the word niggers. I had barked out the word, trying to give it as much meanness and venom as I could. It hung in the air, an all but palpable accusation. Continuing, Bailey had asked James, "You say that you did not. You do not use that word at all, do you?" Bailey knew it was the perfect question on cross-examination, as he explained in the book. "I knew that if James denied using the word, I could put the investigator on the stand to refute him, thereby impeaching that statement and casting doubt on the rest of his testimony as well." James tried to wiggle out of a firm commitment on the issue, but Bailey never forgot the reaction of a black woman juror on hearing the nigger testimony. The juror next to her, another woman, kept patting her on the knee the whole time, saying what even an amateur lip reader could recognize as, "Calm down now, calm down." Moments after his confrontation with Clark on March 15th, Bailey sought to recreate almost word for word his cross-examination of Jimmy James with Mark Furman. "Do you use the word nigger in describing people?" "No, sir," said Furman. "Have you used that word in the past 10 years? "Not that I recall, no." Bailey was too clever to let Furman plead a failure of recollection. "You mean if you called someone a nigger, you have forgotten it?" "I'm not sure I can answer the question the way you phrased it, sir." Bailey was going to make sure he had Furman's denial down cold. What followed was perhaps the most quoted exchange in the entire trial. "Are you therefore saying that you have not used that word in the past 10 years, Detective Furman?" "Yes," Furman said with just a touch of nervousness. "That is what I'm saying." "And you say under oath that you have not addressed any black person as a nigger or spoken about black people as niggers in the past 10 years, Detective Furman?" "That's what I'm saying, sir." "So that anyone who comes to this court and quotes you as using that word in dealing with African Americans would be a liar, would they not, Detective Furman?" "Yes, they would." "All of them, correct?" "All of them." "All right," said Bailey. "Thank you." Bailey had closed every possible escape hatch. Marcia Clark could have cried in frustration. She knew without knowing, knew without being told, that Furman had probably said nigger in the past decade. At that point, there was nothing she could do. After embracing Furman during his direct testimony, there was no way she could distance herself from him at this point. When it came time to conduct a redirect examination, she tried, with a growing sense of futility, to focus the jury on what mattered in his testimony. "The first time you walked out to the South Pathway at 360 South Rockingham, did you know the time of death for Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown?" "No," said Furman. "Did you know whether Mr. Simpson had an alibi for the time of their murders?" "No." "Did you know whether there were any eyewitnesses to their murders?" "No." "Did you know whether anyone had heard voices or any sounds or any words spoken at the crime scene at the time of their murders?" "No." "Did you know whether Cato had already gone up the South Walkway before you got there?" "No." "Did you know whether any fibers from the Bronco would be found on that glove that you ultimately found at Rockingham?" "No." "And did you know the cause of death?" "No." That was Clark's entire redirect examination of Furman. 7 questions. Brevity is bravery in a courtroom, and Clark made her point as strongly as she could. Whatever Mark Furman's character defects, it would have been sheer irrationality for him to plant that glove. With the Furman testimony behind them, Shapiro and Bailey were free to return to their top priorities, themselves. Bailey, who for many years had lived by the sword of public acclaim, was now dying by the sword of expert condemnation of his cross-examination of Furman. Despite his public mask of bravado, this criticism wounded Bailey, and he set off on a rather desperate attempt to pump up his reputation. Like an actor promoting a movie, Bailey did the rounds of interviews to praise his own performance. Bailey hosted an elegant dinner party on Friday, March 17th, at the Beverly Hills home of a friend. At the appropriate hour, television sets were wheeled before the guests, so Bailey could watch himself being interviewed on ABC's 2020. Correspondent Cynthia McFadden asked Bailey if OJ had been pleased with his cross-examination of Furman. "He was extremely pleased," Bailey said. And the reason was that Carl Douglas and Johnny Cochran and OJ himself all felt that it was very successful from the perspective of jury reaction. They did not feel that Mark Furman had been bought by this jury, and that was the only issue. They really didn't care what you people thought. Bailey was so desperate for approval that he even invoked his nemesis, Marcia Clark, as a witness in his own behalf. Bailey told David Margalek of the New York Times that he received a very nice compliment from Miss Clark about his cross. To Bryant Gumbel on Today, Bailey said, "We met the objectives that we set out to meet, but we dug Furman in the hole that we wanted to dig, and he jumped into it." To Time magazine, Bailey boasted, "Johnny Cochran and O.J. Simpson understand that jury the way no white lawyer will. Day 2 and 3 of Furman's cross, we got very good vibes. Norman Mailer called me and said it was flawless. So I feel good." Shapiro had his own strategy for reputation overhaul. After Furman left the stand on March 16th, Shapiro issued an extraordinary public statement from the steps of the courthouse, in which he essentially denounced his colleague's cross-examination of the detective. "My preference," Shapiro told a flock of cameras, "was that race was not an issue in this case, and should not be an issue in this case, and I'm sorry from my personal point of view that it has become an issue in this case." This was an especially shameless display by Shapiro, considering that he had launched the race-based defense onslaught against Furman in the first place. But times had changed. With Simpson's defense in other hands, Shapiro now cared more about ingratiating himself with West Los Angeles, i.e., white society. This statement was a public step in that direction. After court broke the following day, March 17th, Shapiro spent the rest of the afternoon hanging around Larry King's room at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. Of course, the Shapiros were pointedly not invited to Bailey's soiree that evening. Shapiro and King had become friends over the course of the case, and Shapiro confided that he was miserable. He told King that he loathed both Bailey and Cochran and wanted nothing more than to get off the case. Shapiro tagged along when King went to the CNN studio on Sunset Boulevard to do his show. King's guests that night were Alan Dershowitz and Dennis Zine, the head of the Los Angeles Police Union. Dershowitz had caused a minor storm the previous week when he asserted that many cops were trained to lie on the witness stand. And the professor reiterated his attacks on police in general, and the LAPD in particular, over the course of the broadcast. At the end of the show, which he watched from just off camera, Shapiro greeted Dershowitz with a single observation that summed up his alienation from his colleagues on the defense team. "You're going crazy, Alan," Shapiro said. Shapiro brought his pestilence into the courtroom the following week. He made only his second appearance of the case, questioning Denise Brown was the first, when he cross-examined Philip Van Adder. Under direct examination by Darden, Lang's partner and the co-lead detective on the case did little more than corroborate what Phillips, Lang, and Furman had told the jury earlier. Shapiro did a competent job of cross-examining Van Atter, focusing on his false statements in the search warrant affidavit for Simpson's home, and the detective's decision to carry O.J.'s blood sample all the way from Parker Center to Simpson's house in Brentwood. Rather than reflecting conspiratorial behavior, Van Atter's delivery of the blood merely illustrated his own laziness. By giving the blood to Dennis Fong at O.J.'s house, Van Atter spared himself the headache of stopping at another location and doing the paperwork on the evidence. What was striking about Shapiro that day was his appearance. The lawyer conducted the questioning while wearing a blue ribbon on his lapel. The chief of the LAPD, Willie Williams, had started a campaign for citizens to wear these lapel pins in support of the police. Williams had very explicitly stated that the pins stood for defending police officers against the accusations leveled at them by O.J. Simpson's lawyers. Shapiro never made clear just why, other than perhaps sheer perversity, he had decided to wear one. To mock Shapiro around Cochran's office, investigator Pat McKenna also took to wearing a blue pin on the fly of his pants. Shapiro's blue pin gesture nearly drove his client over the top. Coming right after Shapiro attacked Bailey's cross-examination of Furman, the lapel pin was too much. Simpson gave Shapiro an ultimatum. One more stunt, and you're off the team. This would have been Shapiro's opportunity to flee, that is, if he had really wanted off. But in his heart, Shapiro loved the attention that came to him as a result of the Simpson case. The knowing winks from celebrities, the autograph seekers. Shapiro also knew, even before the trial had started, that he wanted to write a book about it. He couldn't give it all up now. Better, he decided, to spend the remainder of the trial as a guest at the Thanksgiving from hell, stuck at a table with people you could neither abide nor escape. Marcia Clark was suffering, too. Bad enough that she was beset by the tabloids and a vengeful ex-husband. Worse yet, she was watching the Simpson case become more racial morality play than murder trial. Clark had a gift for surviving on very little sleep, but so, alas, did her two sons, and they did not always choose the same 5 hours as each other or as their mother. Red-eyed, she would complain in the morning, "I got double-teamed again last night." All of that, plus her incessant smoking, gave her a cold marked by a persistent hacking cough and watery, bulging eyes. She was sick for weeks. And then she had to deal with Cato Kalin. His life was the antithesis of Clark's. Carefree, aimless, without plan or responsibility. In fact, Kalin's cuddly image obscured a darker personal history. He may have looked and acted like a teenage slacker, but he was a lot closer to 40 than 20, and his perpetual freeloading was viewed with scorn by his ex-wife, the mother of their daughter, whom Kalin intermittently supported. For that and any number of other reasons, Marcia Clark loathed him. But she needed him. Whatever else he did, Kalin circumscribed O.J.'s alibi. The two men had arrived home from their famous trip to McDonald's at about 9:40 p.m. on June 12th. Kalin had also heard the thumps near the air conditioner, which had prompted Furman's expedition to the pathway behind the house. Clark needed Kalin to place those facts in front of the jury. When Kalin took the stand, twitching, tieless, in black jeans, and of course, his unruly mop of greasy blonde hair, everyone, including the usually deadpan jury, had to smile at his bravura goofiness. On the night of the murders, the jury learned, Kalin spent from 7:45 to 8:30 p.m. in O.J.'s jacuzzi, a marination of almost superhuman duration. At one point, Clark asked him about the clock in Simpson's Bentley, the vehicle they drove to McDonald's. Was this a digital clock? No, Kalin said, and he then began waving his arms in a sort of cretinous attempt to act out the hands of a watch. It was a numbered clock. Well, I mean numerals. He stumbled along. A digit would be that, too, but you know what I'm saying. Ito finally ended the agony. Analog, he said. Clark did get an interesting new fact out of the witness. It was always the prosecution's theory that Simpson, while planning the murder, had tried to use Kalin to set up his alibi. After Simpson returned from Sydney's dance recital, he did something he had never done before, knocked on Kalin's door, and said he only had $100 bills on him and needed a five to tip the skycap at the airport later that night. Kalin didn't have a five either, but he did give Simpson a $20 bill. Also during that visit, Simpson told Kalin he was going to get something to eat. Had all gone according to Simpson's plan, Kalin would have reported this conversation to the police later. However, to Simpson's surprise, Kalin invited himself along. They had never gone to dinner together previously. Simpson agreed to take Kalin, and the two men made a quick trip together to McDonald's, a time when, according to Kalin, Simpson was brooding about Nicole's inappropriately sexy attire at the recital. The key new testimony concerned payment at the drive-through window. Kalin had handed Simpson a $20 bill with which to pay, and after paying, Simpson had handed all of the change back to Kalin. So even though Simpson went to Kalin's room with the stated purpose of getting a $5 bill from him, he never took it, even when he had the chance at McDonald's. Interesting circumstantial evidence that Simpson had tried to use Kalin to set up an alibi for a premeditated murder. Simpson had dictated a memo from jail advising Shapiro how to cross-examine Kalin, urging the lawyer to establish that on the night of the murders his attitude was just kicking back, was tired, and that was his frame of mind. Shapiro followed his client's advice, and Kalin did portray Simpson's demeanor as more matter-of-fact than tense. In the prelim, Kalin had suggested Simpson was in a dark mood that evening, and the shift in his testimony enraged Clark. She displayed great impatience with Kalin during his redirect testimony and even had Ito declare him a hostile witness, which entitled her to ask him leading questions. Ultimately, Clark did get the bare minimum she needed out of him, but her hostility, combined with Kalin's vapidity, made this witness ultimately a lost opportunity for the prosecution. Not so Alan Park, who represented one of the rare occasions when fortune smiled on the prosecutors. Poised, intelligent, with a record of cellular telephone calls to corroborate his story about the night in question, the man who drove Simpson to the airport in a limousine proved a devastatingly incriminating witness. Nervous about picking up a celebrity for the first time, Park had arrived for his 10:45 p.m. pickup about 20 minutes early. He drove up Rockingham at about 10:25 p.m., and this was crucial. Simpson's Bronco was not there. He made a right turn on Ashford and waited. He rang Simpson's bell at about 10:40 p.m. No answer. He went around the corner to the Rockingham gate. No signs of life, and still no Bronco parked there. Park began to panic. He didn't want Simpson to miss his 11:45 p.m. flight to Chicago. Using the limo's cell phone, Park called his boss. He even called his mother. He kept ringing the bell to the house. Peering through the gate, he saw that the house was dark, except for a single light upstairs. At 10:52 p.m., Park's boss called him in the limo. A minute or two later, two sights caught the driver's eye. First, a man, Kalin, emerged briefly from the shadows near the back of the house. Second, in front of the house, a 6-foot, 200-pound black person walked into the front door of the house from outside. Park buzzed again. For the first time, the lights went on downstairs, and O.J. Simpson answered the intercom, then opened the gate by remote control. "I overslept," Simpson said. "I just got out of the shower, and I'll be down in a minute." Clark knew how to milk a moment in the courtroom. so she asked Simpson to rise from his seat at the defense table. "Can you tell us," she asked Park, "if that appears to be the size of the person that you saw enter the front entrance of the house at Rockingham?" Cochran objected. Ito overruled him. Simpson winced, as if in physical pain. "Yes, around the size," said Park. Simpson spent about 5 minutes rooting around in the now fully lit house and rushed downstairs with a few bags, Park said. Kalin and Park helped him load them into the car, although Simpson insisted that only he touch a small black duffel bag. Prosecutors argued that this bag held the clothes Simpson wore during the murders. When Park drove his limo down the driveway and made a left onto Rockingham, he noticed something that was different from when he had arrived. The Rockingham curb had been empty at 10:25, but at this point, shortly after 11, something was obstructing my view on the right. Apparently, the Bronco. In other words, O.J. Simpson's Bronco was not parked by his house at the time of the murders, but it was there after Simpson materialized back at his house. It was startling evidence of Simpson's guilt. Cochran made scarcely a whit of progress on cross-examination. James Williams was the skycap who had checked Simpson's bags through to Chicago at Los Angeles International Airport. In brief testimony after Parks, Clark had Williams explain that there was a big trash can on the sidewalk in the area where Simpson got out of Parks' limousine. The implication, which Clark never stated directly before the jury, was that Simpson might have discarded, in that trash can, the small black duffel bag he had insisted on handling back at his house. Carl Douglas rose to cross-examine, full of bluster. Clark's insinuations about the trash can were so vague that a more confident lawyer might simply have ignored them. But Douglas would not be deterred. "Mr. Williams," Douglas barked out, "you don't recall ever seeing Mr. Simpson anywhere near that trash on June the 12th, do you, sir?" Williams didn't hesitate. "Yes, he was standing near the trash can." Douglas looked like he had been clubbed with a 2x4. Clark stifled a smile. Williams stepped down on the afternoon of March 29th. And on that rare happy note for her in Department 103, Marcia Clark effectively disappeared from the case. She did not examine another witness for nearly 3 full months, until June 21st. Preoccupied with her divorce case, she rarely even made it to court on time. Over the following weeks, it was often 9:30 a.m. or later when Clark burst through the courtroom double doors and, juggling purse, files, and food, settled noisily into her seat. The jurors, who as near prisoners had to rise daily at 5:30 a.m. and thus had no choice about being on time, regarded Clark's entrances with long, cold stares. Chapter 18. The Best Trial Lawyer. Barry Scheck looked different and sounded different. His entire wardrobe of ill-fitting, double-breasted suits probably cost less than just one of Cochran's or Shapiro's buttery ensembles. In more ways than one, Scheck spoke in a language that few in the courtroom understood. There was his accent, for starters, a New York honk that never blended into the beige California soundscape. But there was also his vocabulary, the language of forensic DNA technology, with its alleles, autorads, and daughter ions. When Scheck first turned up in the case at a handful of hearings during the summer of 1994, he and his partner, Peter Neufeld, seemed rarely even to talk to their colleagues at the defense table. But the courtroom camera never caught the most important difference between Scheck and the other defense lawyers. Scheck worked. Cochran left the detail work to Carl Douglas. Shapiro enjoyed a nap after a day in court. When Scheck left Ito's courtroom, he would bend his pudgy frame over a table in Cochran's office suite and examine the scientific evidence against O.J. Simpson the way no criminal prosecution case had been scrutinized before. When Shapiro had hired him the week after the murders, it wasn't even clear what Scheck's role would be. The vague idea was that Scheck and Neufeld would brief Shapiro for the hearing on the admissibility of DNA evidence. At that point, the idea that Barry Scheck would deliver one of the closing jury arguments in the case would have been laughable. But by dint of the sheer quality and quantity of his effort, Scheck emerged, after Cochran, as the most important trial lawyer in the case, and in terms of courtroom skills, the single best trier lawyer as well. What Scheck did in those endless sessions at the table in Cochran's office was construct a brilliant defense. The genius of it was that it merged perfectly with the cruder race-based strategy Shapiro and Cochran had orchestrated from the beginning. As with the race defense, Scheck's efforts had little to do with establishing that someone other than Simpson had murdered Ron and Nicole. Far from it. Scheck's work had everything to do with undermining the integrity and competence of the LAPD. The results of the LAPD's work, Scheck told the jury, could not be trusted. Cochran attacked the hearts of the policemen, Scheck, their minds. Scheck's goal epitomized the nihilistic function of a defense lawyer, to establish that the mountain of forensic evidence against his client means nothing. The most remarkable thing was that Scheck actually accomplished this goal. By the end of the case, he had a plausible scientific basis for arguing away every piece of physical evidence against Simpson. To be sure, many of these explanations were fanciful, and some were silly. They were, in part, contradictory to one another, positing a police department that was both totally inept and brilliantly sinister. Scheck's arguments presupposed a conspiracy so immense within the LAPD that, analyzed objectively, it seemed a practical impossibility. But Scheck's passion and skill made his theories real for the jury, and for that reason, he, as much as any other person in that courtroom, was responsible for the verdict that came out of it. With a shift of about a half dozen years, Barry Scheck might have been Marcia Clark, and she, him. Both came from upwardly mobile, middle-class Jewish families that stressed education and liberal politics. Both were smart, verbal kids who did well in school. Both seemed destined to be lawyers. But Scheck, born in 1949, came of age at a time when the highest goal for a liberal lawyer was to fight the system. As a criminal defense lawyer, at least, and a legal aid lawyer, at best. A few years later, kids like him would become prosecutors. Besides, Barry couldn't dance. His father, George Scheck, had been born into a poor family of eight children on Manhattan's Lower East Side. George dropped out of elementary school and started hanging around a bank, where the janitor taught him to tap dance. George became so skilled that he was one of the few white men of his generation to play the Apollo in Harlem. During World War II, George started a local radio review called Swing Shift Follies, which aimed to discover musical talent among the Rosie the Riveters on the assembly lines. After the war, George became a musical talent manager, and he nurtured the early careers of such stars as Bobby Darin, Connie Francis, and Hazel Scott. Thriving, the Schecks and their two children moved from Queens to a big house on Long Island. In 1959, when Barry was 10, the big house burned down. His sister, then 7, died in the fire. The family moved to an apartment in Manhattan. The ordeal may have quite literally broken his father's heart. George couldn't work full-time because of ill health, and he ultimately suffered 12 heart attacks before he died in 1987. Barry's mother was forced into work at an office supply business. They focused their hopes on their one precocious, surviving child. Scheck had a Doonesbury-esque experience at Yale in the 1960s, which was not entirely surprising because his room was across the hall from Gary Trudeau's. When Scheck arrived as a freshman, he wore ties and cast his lot with Yale's Young Democrats. By the time he graduated, he could only enter the Yale Club in New York through a side door because his political convictions demanded that he wear work shirts. Along the way, Scheck presented his draft card to the famous Yale chaplain, William Sloan Coffin, for delivery to the Pentagon in protest of the Vietnam War. Scheck campaigned for Norman Mailer when he ran for mayor of New York City. Still, he did go to law school at Bolt Hall in Berkeley, and after graduating went to work for Legal Aid in the Bronx. Scheck spent about 5 years in that combative, unionized, highly political office, where Neufeld also worked, until he took a job as a clinical law professor at the Benjamin Inn Cardoza School of Law in Lower Manhattan. The position allowed Scheck both to teach and to defend criminal cases, and in 1987 a fellow lawyer called him with a plea for help. The lawyer's client, Joseph Castro, had been charged with murder, and the case against him was based principally on the infant science known as DNA fingerprinting. Scheck and Neufeld agreed to help out. What struck the two lawyers was the hypnotizing power of DNA technology. As they steeped themselves in this new science, they realized that the best way to attack it was from the ground up. That is, through the evidence collection and preservation techniques of the police. The tests themselves were close to unassailable, but they were sensitive too, geared more to laboratory conditions than to the chaos of crime scenes. Garbage in, garbage out. That was the theory. After protracted hearings in the Castro case, Scheck and Neufeld persuaded the judge to exclude the DNA evidence as unreliable. It wasn't wrong, though. Castro himself ultimately pleaded guilty in the case. The power of the technology pricked the two men's social consciences as well. Scheck and Neufeld realized that DNA testing on blood or semen could free the unjustly convicted, and they began representing prisoners they believed were innocent. They recruited Scheck's students at Cardoza to help and called their efforts the Innocence Project. Tracking down forgotten evidence, sometimes many years after the trials that sent their clients to jail, Scheck's team subjected it to DNA testing. In just a few years, they helped more than 15 convicted prison inmates go free. At one level, though, Scheck and Neufeld weren't so different from their more cynical colleagues on the Simpson defense team. There was a conflict in Scheck and Neufeld's two approaches to DNA. They trashed it when it implicated their clients and embraced it when it excluded them. The pair dealt with this state of affairs by resolutely refusing to acknowledge it, asserting instead that DNA matches were simply less reliable than exclusions. But even Scheck's and Neufeld's admirers in the scientific community, and there are many of them, found this position difficult to swallow. According to Richard Lewontin, a professor of population genetics at Harvard, unlike most lawyers, Barry and Peter really know what they're talking about when it comes to the technology. When they've defended clients, they've done brilliant work in showing the problems with the DNA labs. On the other hand, I have to say, they have no compunction about supporting the technology when it's useful for the defense. They are defense attorneys, and they're not always consistent, because they're defense attorneys. The forensic evidence portion of the Simpson case began with the testimony of Dennis Fung, the diminutive, soft-spoken, 34-year-old criminalist who had collected evidence from both Bundy and Rockingham on the morning after the murders. The prosecutor was Hank Goldberg, a skilled appellate advocate, but a trial lawyer with the stage presence of a voicemail attendant. Prodded gently by Goldberg, Fung told the story of how he had collected the various tiny drops and hairs into plastic bags for transportation back to police headquarters. Scheck began cross-examination on the afternoon of April 4th. A junior colleague of Fung's, Andrea Mazzola, had actually assisted the criminalist in processing both crime scenes. It was only Mazzola's third crime scene, and her inexperience proved a matter of some embarrassment to the prosecution. Scheck began exploring whether, in earlier testimony, Fung had exaggerated his own activities in order to play down the role of his novice accomplice. In a pattern that would recur throughout this long cross-examination, Fung at first denied that he had ever before given misleading testimony, but then, pummeled by Scheck, he admitted defeat. "So you didn't tell the grand jury that Andrea Mazzola was actually the one that swatched that red stain off the handle of the Bronco, right?" At the time, Fung stumbled. "Did you tell them that?" "No." "You said you did it." "Yes," said Fung. "And you said the same thing about stain 4 at Rockingham?" "Yes." "5? "Yes." "6? "I don't recall," Fung said, sighing. "But, yes." Scheck thus began by establishing that Fung had made repeated misstatements about the evidence during previous sworn testimony. In Fung's direct testimony, Goldberg could have previewed these problems, fronted them, as lawyers say, but he left Fung to fend for himself against Scheck's meticulously prepared onslaught. Having decimated Fung's credibility, Scheck then went after his competence, using both police and news media photographs of the crime scene to make his point. Scheck established that Fung had neglected to pick up a piece of paper near Goldman's feet, that a blanket covering Nicole's body could have transferred evidence fibers from inside the house, that the glove and the envelope holding Juditha Brown's glasses had been collected after Ron Goldman's body was dragged over them by the coroner. This went on for days, a medley of Fung's mistakes, some trivial, some not. Large purple blotches that looked like bruises began to appear under Fung's eyes. First, Fung said he was sure that he never collected evidence with his bare hands. Then he wasn't sure. First, he was positive that he hadn't collected any evidence until the coroner's representatives had left the scene. Then, after seeing a video, Fung conceded that he had. No, he probably didn't change his rubber gloves as often as he should have. No, he hadn't seen any soil inside Simpson's home at Rockingham. Yes, he should have taken larger samples of blood from O.J.'s Bronco. No, he hadn't noticed any blood on Simpson's socks when he first picked them up at the foot of O.J.'s bed at Rockingham. At least some of these flaws could be attributed to the LAPD's underfunding of its scientific investigative division and undertraining of its personnel. But whatever the reasons, the failures reflected on the prosecution's case against O.J. Simpson. It was a brilliant and devastating cross-examination. These efforts served a larger goal than merely embarrassing Dennis Fung. Scheck used them to offer a comprehensive view of the evidence. His dissection of the blood evidence on the back gate at Bundy was a classic demonstration of the Scheck method. Through sheer intellectual calisthenics, Scheck not only neutralized some of the most powerful evidence in the case against Simpson, but turned it into arguable proof of a police conspiracy against him. On first blush, it was devastating evidence. Many of the first cops on the scene noticed the bloody smudge on the back gate. The blood was located just where an intruder might put his left hand to open the gate and leave the pathway that ran along the side of Nicole's house. Furman referred to the blood on the back gate in three separate entries in his contemporaneous notes from the crime scene. The DNA tests on the bloody smudge came back as virtually conclusive. There was only a 1 in 57 billion chance that the blood belonged to someone other than O.J. Simpson, who, of course, had a cut on his left hand on the morning after the murders. There are men on death row with far less persuasive evidence against them. So Scheck went to work. He noticed first that Fung had not collected the blood on the gate until July 3, 1994, 3 weeks after the killings. Fung had explained in his direct examination that he had simply missed this blood when he took samples at the scene on the morning after the murders. Revisiting the scene with Detective Lang later, Fung realized he had to check to see if the blood was still on the back gate. It was, and Fung took it in for testing. Sheck then noticed something curious in the test results. For many of the stains that Fung collected from the walkway outside Nicole's home, the DNA had substantially degraded. As a result, these stains could only be subjected to the PCR type of DNA testing, which yields less precise results than the RFLP method. But the blood on the back gate was scarcely degraded at all. It was so rich in DNA that the police could, and did, do RFLP testing on it. Sheck found this paradoxical. Why would blood that had sat outside for 3 weeks be less degraded than blood that was collected within a few hours of the crime? Sheck saw conspiracy. If the blood had been planted on the rear gate after that first day, and of course after Simpson had given his reference sample to the police, that would explain why it was so rich in DNA. Sheck didn't stop there. He examined photographs of the crime scene. On the morning after the murders, Fung had worked closely with the photographer at the crime scene, but because Fung didn't focus on the rear gate, neither did the photographer. There was no clear photograph of the back gate from those taken on the morning of June 13th. The only head-on pictures of that stain were taken when Fung finally did remove a sample on July 3rd. But Sheck did find one photo from June 13th that revealed a distant view of the back gate. He had it blown up many times. Though the photo was blurry and somewhat ambiguous, Sheck could argue that the blood was simply not there on June 13th. In a dramatic moment in his cross-examination of Fung, Sheck showed Fung the July 3rd photo, where the blood is clearly visible, and then the earlier photo, where it is not. "Where is it, Mr. Fung?" Sheck asked with a sneer in his voice. Fung couldn't say. This exchange ended the court day on April 11th. When Sheck returned to the defense table, Shapiro told him, "Perfect," which it was. Shapiro's only other contribution to the Fung cross-examination was to joke, during a break, that he was eating fortune cookies from the Hung Fung restaurant. He later offered an oleaginous public apology to Fung and all my friends in the Asian American community for the remark. But Sheck wasn't finished. He focused on the preliminary hearing testimony of Thano Peritis, the police nurse who took Simpson's blood sample on the afternoon of June 13th at Parker Center. Peritis had testified on cross-examination at the preliminary hearing that he had taken about 8 milliliters of blood as a sample, a standard amount. Using this fact, Sheck then did something that had probably never been done before in a criminal case. He reviewed the records to see how much of Simpson's blood sample had been used up in all the subsequent testing. Again, Sheck found something peculiar. The subsequent tests accounted for only about 6.5 milliliters of blood. Sheck thus concluded that some of Simpson's blood was missing. Sheck also found an expert to say that the blood on the gate contained EDTA, a preservative used in the test tube where Simpson's blood sample had been stored. Thus, Sheck had the raw material for his counter-narrative of the blood on the back gate. The story went like this. On June 13th, Fung did not collect the blood on the back gate because it wasn't there. The photos were proof of that. Between June 13th and July 3rd, someone, probably Van Adder, planted O.J.'s blood on the back gate. After all, Van Adder, curiously, had brought O.J.'s blood sample all the way back to Brentwood from downtown Los Angeles to hand to Fung. If the photographs themselves were not enough proof that the blood was planted after the fact, the DNA tests themselves were. The DNA of the blood left at the actual crime scene had degraded, but because the blood on the gate came from Simpson's fresh sample, it yielded definitive results. Someone had planted some of Simpson's missing blood on that back gate. QED. Now the prosecution had a response to this story, but it was a complicated one, and it depended in significant part on the jurors believing in the incompetence of the LAPD, which was not a message the government otherwise wanted the jury to accept. First of all, the prosecutors asserted Fung did simply miss the blood on that first morning. On that day, he collected dozens of stains at Rockingham and Bundy, and this one just fell through the cracks. The fact that many police officers saw the blood on the back gate established that it was not planted at some later date. As for the good quality of the back gate blood several weeks later, that too related to a flaw in Fung's work. After Fung collected the samples on June 13th, he placed them in plastic bags and then stored them for several hours in an unair-conditioned truck. In retrospect, it was clear he shouldn't have done that, because heat and humidity degrade DNA. But the blood on the gate spent 3 weeks resting on a clean, painted surface in the cool Brentwood air. Naturally, the DNA in it did not degrade. The photographs proved nothing, establishing only that neither Fung nor the photographer had paid attention to the back gate stains on June 13th. A government expert also challenged Sheck's claim about the presence of the preservative in the blood. In some of the most highly technical evidence in the case, an FBI expert said the blood from the gate contained no EDTA. As for missing blood, that was a figment of Sheck's imagination. Paratus had testified without thinking at the preliminary hearing. He said he took 8 milliliters, but that was just a standard amount. When it comes to such small differences as 1 or 2 milliliters, nurses generally pay little attention to the amount of blood they take from living people. It doesn't make any difference. If more blood is needed, the person can simply give more at another time. And Paratus, who was in poor health, gave a videotaped statement at the trial in which he confessed that he had been too categorical when he testified at the preliminary hearing that he took 8 milliliters from Simpson. It might have been as little as 6.5 milliliters. This important conflict over Paratus's testimony at the prelim showed just how important it was that Dershowitz had succeeded in stopping the grand jury. If prosecutors had indicted Simpson before a grand jury, Paratus never would have been cross-examined before the trial. As for Van Adder's delivery of the blood to Fung in Brentwood, that took place at O.J.'s home on Rockingham. A news video showed Fung placing the vial in his truck outside O.J.'s house. Thus, that blood couldn't have been planted at Nicole's condo on Bundy. More fundamentally, though, the prosecutors wanted the jury to believe that the police did not plant blood on Nicole's back gate because they would not do such a thing. Van Adder, Lang, Fung, they all gave their word that they did not do it. That, the prosecutors believed, should have counted for something. But with a jury predisposed toward sympathy for the defendant and hostility to the police, Sheck's counter-narrative found a receptive audience. Sheck's theories covered far more than just the bloody smudge on the back gate. He argued that the blood drops to the left of the shoe prints at Bundy had been cross-contaminated with Simpson's reference sample. He contended that some nefarious police officer, never named, splashed some of Nicole Brown Simpson's blood on O.J. Simpson's socks, which were recovered from the foot of his bed. Sheck asserted that Mark Furman had planted Ron Goldman's blood in O.J.'s Bronco, though not the way Bailey had contended. Unlike Bailey, who had asserted Furman used the second glove like a paintbrush in the car, Sheck suggested that Goldman's blood simply rubbed off as Furman was illegally rooting around inside Simpson's car while it was parked outside Rockingham in the early morning hours of June 13th. As with the blood on the rear gate at Bundy, Sheck was able to tease some evidentiary support for each of these hypotheses. With the exception of Furman, Sheck never named the perpetrators of these misdeeds, nor did he explain how or why so many disparate people, which would include, at a minimum, Furman, Van Adder, Lang, Fung, Mazzola, and 2 other LAPD criminalists, Colin Yamauchi and Michelle Kessler, undertook this massive conspiracy. Still, Scheck's arguments amounted to more than mere conjecture, and he made them earnestly and with zeal. Fong ultimately spent 9 days on the witness stand, and his departure from it prompted one of the more bizarre scenes of the trial. By the end of his ordeal, Fong's pitiful appearance served as the best argument that he was no conspirator. Even if Fong had wanted to frame Simpson, he was clearly so hapless that he didn't seem up to the task. As Fong was ready to step down, Scheck thanked him twice. Fong walked by the prosecution table, where Darden gave him a half-hearted handshake. When he reached the defense table, Fong was greeted like a hero. Johnny Cochran grasped his hand, Shapiro enveloped Fong in a bear hug, then O.J. Simpson reached out and gave Fong a big smile and a handshake. All this for a man who, Scheck contended, had lied to cover up his involvement in a scheme to frame a man for murder. Courtroom security rules prohibit defendants from making such gestures, but the bailiffs, like everyone else, were too stunned to intervene. In its way, the defense team's hearty farewell to Fong displayed a kind of sportsmanship to a vanquished adversary. It is possible to read something more sinister, however. At a minimum, Shapiro, Cochran, and Simpson himself knew how absurd the idea was that Simpson had been framed for this crime. But because of Fong's abysmal performance and Goldberg's inferior preparation of him, that idea had achieved some currency in front of the jury. No wonder the defense wanted to thank him. Andrea Mazzola followed her boss to the stand and endured a similar, though not so disastrous, ordeal. A shy and ingenuous young woman with an apparently sincere passion for forensics, Mazzola did admit making a few minor errors in handling the evidence, not changing gloves frequently enough, and things like that. But Peter Neufeld's sneering cross-examination made no progress in portraying her as a member of some grand conspiracy. Mazzola lingered on the stand for more than a week, which meant that the prosecution presented only 2 witnesses, Fong and Mazzola, in the entire month of April. What followed should have been the highlight of the prosecution's case, the presentation of the results of the DNA testing. Garcetti had recruited 2 of the top DNA prosecutors in the state to present this portion of the evidence, Rockne Harmon from Oakland and Woody Clark from San Diego. Earlier in the case, these 2 had offered to step aside and let one of the local prosecutors handle the evidence in front of the jury. But facing too many witnesses in too little time, and also wanting to share the limelight, Marcia Clark had let Rockne and Woody handle it. The result, probably inevitably, was that this part of the case expanded. When Woody Clark put on Robin Cotton, the laboratory director at Cellmark, the private DNA operation in Maryland that did much of the testing in the case, Clark spent a full day and a half just on introducing the technology to the jury. In a subsequent trial, shortly after Simpson's, Cotton began giving DNA results after just 1 hour of preliminaries. Attempting to be thorough, Woody Clark made the subject boring and incomprehensible, especially to an uneducated jury. Still, the results of the more precise RFLP type of DNA testing were striking. For one of the blood drops on the path at Bundy, the odds were 1 in 170 million that it came from anyone other than Simpson. For the blood on the socks found in Simpson's bedroom, the odds were 1 in 6.8 billion that they came from anyone other than Nicole Brown Simpson. There are about 5 billion people on Earth. The results from the less exact PCR tests were less impressive only because of the overwhelming numbers from the RFLP testing. The PCR odds in the blood evidence mostly came back as 1 in several thousand. In every one of several dozen tests, the DNA results matched the prosecution's theory of the case. OJ's blood to the left of the bloody shoe prints at Bundy, Ron Goldman's blood in the Bronco and on the bloody glove found at Rockingham, O.J.'s blood again in the foyer of his home on Rockingham. In the case on which Marcia Clark and Phil Van Adder had first worked together, they had won a conviction based on a single fingernail-sized drop of blood found in a car truck. The Simpson case, in contrast, probably featured more DNA evidence than any criminal trial in American history. But the possibility of evidence planting cast a pall over all of these prosecution numbers, impressive as they were. If police had swabbed Simpson's and the victim's blood at the crime scenes, then of course the numbers would be overwhelming. It was Barry Scheck who succeeded in undermining the significance of this evidence for the jury. Whatever the jury may have thought, the DNA testimony had a shattering impact among O.J. Simpson's wealthy friends in West Los Angeles. At this stage of the trial, his most prized supporters melted away. Among them, Alan Schwartz, a clothing wholesaler, and probably O.J.'s closest friend in Brentwood, and Alan Austin, a boutique owner and O.J.'s most frequent golfing partner. Now they finally knew what they didn't want to know, that O.J. had killed Nicole, whom many of these men had grown to care for over the years. The DNA testimony shrank Simpson's coterie of white friends to a lonely pair. Don Ohlmeyer, president of NBC's West Coast operations, and Craig Baumgarten, a movie producer. It was perhaps because of this abandonment that O.J. Simpson, seemingly the only person in the courtroom to do so, took the DNA evidence so hard. As Robin Cotton or Gary Sims, the California Department of Justice DNA expert, gave their reports, Simpson greeted them with nervous monologues to Cochran or Shapiro, or whoever happened to be seated next to him at the defense table. Usually impassive, Simpson greeted the enormous DNA numbers with scowls of derision. Though the jury had yet to speak, at this point Simpson knew with certainty that his former life was over. The friends, the hangers-on, the world of being O.J. was now clearly gone forever.
Context of white supremacy. So that is our first audio segment. We will pick back up. We are in the middle of chapter 18. The length and complexity of the DNA testimony pushed the trial toward a kind of giddy exhaustion. That's where we will resume chapter 18. If you have commentary, questions, thoughts, the number to dial 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Email is untiljustice@gmail.com. So we have two audio segments to share, and then we will get commentary from the listeners. Now, we just heard again, right? We were talking about the DNA evidence. I'll read the sentence again. They say, in a subsequent trial, shortly after Simpson's, Cotton began giving DNA results. Attempting to be thorough, Woody Clark made the subject boring and incomprehensible, talking about the DNA evidence, especially to an uneducated jury. Now, throughout this book, there have been many, many moments where Tubin has talked about dumb and ignorant black people. In fact, he started the book even before the table of contents. He has the letter purportedly written by O.J. Simpson with all these typos and saying O.J. Simpson is an illiterate, no count, uneducated black brute murderer, right? That's how he starts the book. And in fact, one of the most important paragraphs in the book. This is how chapter 9 starts. He says, one of the enduring fictions of the Simpson case was the notion of the defendant himself as involved in his defense. Press reports persistently portrayed Simpson as virtually a member of his own defense team. OJ, it was said, was plotting strategy and planning his own defense. Simpson's attorneys manufactured this idea primarily as a gift to their client and as a way of remaining in his good graces. Moreover, the idea of Simpson as a formidable figure in his own right, an African American of stature, helped rally black support to him. In addition, the lawyers knew that many journalists would take their line about Simpson's level of involvement at face value, even as it was transparently false. Treating Simpson as the equal of his lawyers fit nicely with the paternalistic approach many mainstream journalists take in writing about race. According to these informal standards, white reporters can write with candor about the intellectual limitations of their fellow whites, but not blacks. Absurdly, black sensibilities are thought to be too tender for the truth. Indeed, it is thought to be flirting with a charge of racism to draw attention to the intellectual limitations of any African American, especially a prominent one like Simpson. So accepting the idea of Simpson as the peer of his attorneys relieved the mainstream press of confronting obvious truth about him, that he was an uneducated, semi-illiterate ex-athlete who could barely understand much about the legal proceedings against him. I think that is one of the most important paragraphs in this book. That is the first paragraph of chapter 9, which is kind of explaining how Johnny Cochran got involved in this case. That paragraph right there, I said he talks about that theme throughout the book. O.J. Simpson is dumb, illiterate, brute killer. Chris Darden, he also starts the book saying Marsha Clark is arrogant. Christopher Darden is incompetent. He's just ignorant. He's a child. He's immature. He's a little petulant, pouting child. And he's ignorant and incompetent. We haven't even got to the gloves yet. And then the jury. Remember, do you remember masturbating Jeffrey Toobin had the gall? He had the audacity, the gumption to list the academic credentials of the mostly black juror. Do you remember? He said they don't have newspaper subscriptions. They don't have magazine subscriptions. They can't spell National Geographic. They don't have a college degree. Remember that? He went through all the qualifications to talk about how dumb and stupid and illiterate this black jury is. Jeffrey Toobin doesn't include, there's no book that could replicate everything from the trial, but there are a lot of things that you will miss if you don't watch the trial and or just read the transcript and you just depend on Jeffrey Toobin to tell you. Now, if I listen to Jeffrey Toobin, I would think that every black person involved with this case, except for Johnny Cochran, is an absolute idiot, moron, uneducated buffoon. And in the system of white supremacy, they do that sort of thing all the time, as though white people are just Rhodes scholars, brilliant MacArthur geniuses, all of them. Jeffrey Toobin did not include one bit of testimony from March 13th. One quick sound clip. This is F. Lee Bailey. Man, I wish I knew about this when F. Lee Bailey was on the program. F. Lee Bailey questioning Mark Furman about his academic status.
Would you share with us, Detective Furman, some of your educational background? High school, college, that sort of thing.
I went to Peninsula High School. I did not complete. I got a GED. I probably got...
A GED is?
General Education Equivalency Diploma.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record.
All right. I dropped out of school. Dropped out. Sorry. Got myself a GED. You know what GED stands for? Good Enough Diploma. You know what GED's bullshit is? Now, let me get this straight. I can make it 4 years in 6 hours.
I want you to Pondy replay drama. Pondy replay.
Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
I got a GED. I probably got...
A GED is?
General education equivalency diploma.
Mm-hmm.
I attended one, two, three community colleges. I believe I currently hold approximately 47 units college.
What would that be in years?
Close to 2 years.
And what did you study?
History, police science, art.
Okay. And have you had any other education beyond these community college experiences?
Are you saying a formal education, sir, that I sought out?
Training courses, anything that would qualify as instruction.
Oh, yes, numerous, okay. Numerous courses.
Gus T. Renegade, the black O.J. Simpson. Let me be explicit. No disrespect to anyone who dropped out of high school if you're a victim of racism. No disrespect to any victim of racism if you have a GED. No disrespect to any victim of racism if you attended community college at any point. I have a few community college credits on my transcript. No, it's nothing incorrect about that at all. Education is education. All of that sincerely said, you're going to tell me, like, I was so in. Let me rewind again. I was washing dishes 2 days ago, listening to the trial. I'm preparing for the program. Let's hear what happened on March 13th. So I'm listening. GED. Did he say three community colleges? I turned off the water and walked away. In fact, let me tell you one other thing I did. We had Clarence Lussain as a guest on this program in 2010, 12 years, context of white supremacy, a dozen years we've been on the air. Clarence Lussain was a guest on the program in 2010. We talked about his book, Pipe Dream Blues, which is all about how racism, white supremacy has used the so-called drug war to attack black people. This book was published probably about 30 years ago. He's still alive, black male, great scholar. He has one line in that book. It reads, "A white high school dropout, Mark Furman, will have a better chance of finding work than a black college graduate." I read that way before the cows existed. I remember the first time I saw that, like, this year has been like deflating, something that robs you of motivation where I don't really feel like doing a whole lot. I'm good. Yes, I'll just be lazy about things. If this is the world that we live in, yes, I will just be shiftless and lazy and not make too much of an effort to do anything. I remember that is exactly how I felt when I read that line. That is one of the first things I thought of when I heard that testimony. This testimony, that is from the witness stand. High school dropout, GED, not one, not two, three community colleges. I don't know any black people who went to three. And again, no disrespect. Education is education. But I mean, what type of no count shiftless white guy is this? And then the other thing I thought about, oh, it was so many things. That was like the Wednesday. Like, what in the world? What are we talking about? Edward Snowden, remember that? Shook the whole world, released all these security documents. The same thing. High school dropout, community. Like, you, for Jeff Toobin or any individual classified as white to look me in the face and have the gall to utter one syllable about the uneducated Negro. What, we just had the whole diploma mill and oh yes, I got a 4.1 GPA actually, and was captain of the soccer team. What was it? Equestrian. Yes, equestrian team, and was in National Honor Society. Yes, and then found out. Oh no, no, I just was shiftless and watching cartoons for 4 years, and then had the audacity. The black jurors are ignorant. You know, they don't have any newspaper subscriptions. They don't have a college degree. Remember, he said Nicole Brown Simpson and her sisters between them had more breast augmentations than degrees. And you're going to tell me about the uneducated niggers on the jury who can't understand DNA evidence. Are you serious? Third, O.J. Simpson is a millionaire at the time that this happened. Hall of Fame football player, making movies, lives in Brentwood, unofficial title, the mayor of Brentwood. Are you telling me that a white man, a high school dropout, GED holding white man who is a three-time college, community college loser, can ruin your whole life if he planted that glove on O.J. Simpson? Is that what you're telling me in a system of white? I heard all this about class and meritocracy. Are you telling me a high school dropout is at the... That was Wednesday. Next sound clip. So, Tubin and many other people, they love, I guess this might be Negro incompetence too. They love to bring up the moment when Carl Douglas, when he is questioning James Williams, this is the skycap at LAX airport. They're questioning him about, did you see O.J. Simpson throw something into the trash can? And so Mr. Williams, he responds, first he says, you didn't see him at the trash can. And Mr. Williams responds, oh, yeah, I did see him at the trash can. Marsha Clark has a portion in her book where she talks about this. They have a segment. I'm going to play you the audio clip, but I'm just rewinding. When Tubin writes about this, look at the language. He says, Mr. Williams, Douglas barked out. The man not. He didn't ask. He didn't question. He barked. He's a dog. Douglas barked out. You don't recall ever seeing Mr. Simpson anywhere near that trash on June the 12th, do you, sir? Williams didn't hesitate. Yes, he was standing near the trash can. Douglas looked like he'd been clubbed with a 2x4. Clark stifled a smile. Clubbed by a 2x4. I regularly talk about how racist jokes are frequently celebrating violence against black people. So we're in a double murder trial, I thought, right? This is all about humanity and all that. So one, he's a dog, not an attorney, who now has his own firm. Two, he had been clubbed by a 2x4. And like I said, this is rampant. They use this like this is some huge dramatic moment. If you watch the trial, matter of fact, I'm going to give you another example. Court TV, when they did their special, they did the same thing. They do a commercial cut. So you'll hear the commercial cut, and then you'll hear actually how did this play out in trial to give you the full context and not the racist propaganda drama segment. So this is Mr. Douglas questioning the skycap James Williams, context of white supremacy.
Mr. Williams, you don't recall ever seeing Mr. Simpson anywhere near that trash can on June the 12th, do you, sir?
Yes, he was standing near the trash can.
Could O.J. Simpson have gotten rid of his blood-soaked clothes and the knife after the murders? That's what the prosecution is trying to get the jurors to believe. Next, the baggage handler who checked in Simpson's luggage takes the stand.
Mr. Williams, you don't recall ever seeing Mr. Simpson anywhere near that trash can on June the 12th, do you, sir?
Yes, he was standing near the trash can.
Did you see him do anything with the trash can?
No, I didn't see him do anything with the trash can.
We know that on the night of the murder, he flew to Chicago and came home, and these bloody clothes were nowhere to be found.
He's watching the trial. He gets pissed off. He calls me in the office and tells me the story. I took him to Marcia, and I said, you want to know where the shoes are or the knife? This guy sold you stuffing them in a trash container.
That witness was there to pick up his wife, who was a flight attendant at the same airline.
And where's that little half-moon-shaped travel bag? Nobody knows. We know what was in that travel bag. Can we prove it? No, it's gone forever. But if I'm on the jury, I want to hear what this witness has to say. You never, however, have too much evidence in a murder case, ever. You put everything on. Balls of the walls. If it doesn't go, it doesn't go. Marcia did not want to appear in bed with the LAPD in front of this jury because it was about Rodney King. It was about the LA riots, some of the most deadly riots in the city's history, in the nation's history. Nobody in that jury liked these cops.
Oh, nobody liked the cops. That was Detective Tom Lang, just so that you know. Detective Tom Lang, mentioned frequently in the book, was on the stand testifying before Mark Furman. Balls to the walls, the metaphors, balls to the walls, and Marcia Clark didn't want to appear in bed with the police. What does that mean? Especially, she just said, we had to mollycoddle Mark Furman. We had to meet with him 7-8 times and go over his testimony and do all this. What do you mean she didn't want to be in bed with the police? The beginning, that was just 2 minutes. But again, it would be better to watch the trial or read the transcript, because Jeffrey Toobin and pretty much everybody, all of the folks, the evidence is not with them. Folks who are saying O.J. Simpson did this, he is the butcher of Brentwood. So what they do often is lie. And frequently they share the same lies. You heard the testimony. Mr. Williams, did you see him dumping anything in the trash can? Nope. Did they have any witness who came to testify? We see him dump something in the trash can? No. And again, following logic, I wasn't there. I reckon it's possible OJ could have committed these crimes, but if I'm just following logic, I'm a black male in a system of white supremacy. Susan Smith killed her two children and blamed it on a black male wearing a knit cap 4 months after O.J. Simpson was arrested and charged with these crimes. If I'm a black male and I just killed two white people, one of them a white woman, and I have a history of abusing this white woman, a criminal record for abusing this white woman, am I going to go to LAX, unless I'm mistaken, one of the most trafficked airports on the West Coast, maybe in North America, I could be incorrect, but certainly on the West Coast, one of the busier, if not busiest, airport. Am I going to go to this airport? Now, yes, it's late on a Sunday evening, but it's still summertime, LAX, and I'm O.J. Simpson. You have multiple witnesses who come and testify. Yes, I got an autograph at the airport. Yes, I talked to him at the airport. People who talked to him on the plane got an airport, got an autograph from him on the plane, including the pilot who testified. Did you see something wrong with his hand? Did you see a cut? Did you see any blood? Was he acting crazy? Did he seem, you know, paranoid? No. On all accounts, no cut. He was not acting paranoid. He was not bleeding. Calm. O.J. Simpson signing autographs. Nothing wrong with his hand. Didn't seem like he had a care in the world. And no, I did not see him dispose of anything. But forget all that. There are cameras. Yes, this is before 9/11. Yes, there are cameras at LAX. They had cameras and they went through all the trash. I said that before. This is unparalleled law enforcement effort. They went through the trash at LAX
and in Chicago. Remember, we had Patrick McKenna on the program. He talked about how they had the dogs because the World Cup for soccer was in Chicago. They used the Secret Service dogs in Chicago. They went through all the trash at LAX and at the landfill for LAX. So at minimum, we effed up and we should have found it. At minimum, if he dumped it there. But I'm just using logic. Why on earth would I take all? They have metal detectors at the airport in 1994. Why am I going to take this to the airport in front of all these people? I'm having to fight them off to sign autographs. I'm rushing. I'm late to get there anyway, so I'm going to have to rush through that. Does that make sense that you would do this? Balls to the wall. And again, just like Jill Shively, white people swearing up and down that they have white people, other white people who had damning evidence, totally incriminating. I saw O.J. Simpson speeding away from the trial. I saw him disposing of the knife. But somehow, some way, these folks just don't find their way to the witness stand. If you've known where white people have a problem and or are fearful of accusing or being willing to testify against a black person, any black person, any black person, please share. 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let us know when you share. Did you know Mark Furman, high school dropout, GED, 3 different community colleges. In fact, he said about, he might have been lying because he said about 47 credit hours. *61 if you have. I bet it's people here who have master's degrees and PhDs and have way less power than Mark GED Furman, Gusty included. Folks who dialed in with commentary, proceed. Give folks a second to get their thoughts together. I see a few hands. Let's see.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Ohio.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. I did also catch when Tubin had said the evidence would be too boring, and I forgot the other word that's used, for the uneducated jury. And I had started reading, I haven't finished it, I'm not even halfway through the book, but I started reading Madam Foreman, the book written by 3 of the black female jurors. And it is like somewhat cumbersome because they add like a lot of details. But one of the things that directly contradicts a lot of what a lot of these white authors say is that they made it about race. And there was at least one or two of the females in that book who specifically said that they didn't even know it was about race until they were actually able to finally be relieved of their jury duty. So that is interesting. And I think that they did at least graduate high school. I didn't remember hearing any of them saying that they didn't graduate from high school. And it's funny that that was, you know, that you played the clip about Furman saying that he dropped out of high school, because of course he did not mention that in his book. So I think that's it's par for the course, but it is eye opening that he that he is so uneducated, but he was still seen as like the star witness and such a a credible person. The other thing that I wanted to mention, just a few notes. When he was talking about when Tubin was had his whole portion about George Scheck, I think that's what his name is, the father of Barry Scheck. And even his part about Barry Scheck, where he seemed like he was very complimentary compared to the other people in or involved in the Dream Team, quote unquote, how George was taught by was taught to tap dance by a janitor, and then he was the only white man to perform at Apollo. And I thought that was interesting because to me, it kind of seemed like it was the black janitor who taught him how to tap dance. But the only time that Tubin mentioned race was when this white man was able to perform at Apollo, which has been traditionally, historically, a black theater. So it's like, it's interesting how if it's something to do with complimenting a black person, he finds a way to omit it or to turn it around as if they are conniving instead of smart, which he has done numerous times with Cochran. In the part about Scheck, how Scheck was the hardest working person on the Dream Team. Shapiro, he was taking naps after the trial, and Cochran would defer all of his work to another attorney, and Scheck was just the main reason, you know, the main reason, I won't say the main reason, but he was really integral in the defense, which it seemed like everyone except for Shapiro seemed like they were integral in OJ's defense. And even how he described Cochran would attack the hearts of the officers and then Scheck would attack their minds. So that's also, to me, a subliminal way of him saying black people are just emotional. But again, this white man, this Jewish white man, because he mentioned that with the whole Marsha Clark and his comparison, but he was able to intellectually question them. And the last thing I'll mention is the portion about Barry Scheck starting the Innocent Project. And I never knew that, but I wouldn't be surprised if the trial, the fame that he gained in the trial, didn't also help him with that program or whatever you or that organization. And I think that would just be another example of how white people were able to benefit from this trial so many times over. And I would say maybe the only black person who was able to benefit from the trial would be Cochran. And I'll mute my line. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, Red in Ohio. I think there was speculation, or at least there have been other reports. I'm not sure if Barry Scheck has like publicly admitted this, but I think there are a number of reports that that was the plan. That was at least one of the reasons that Scheck wanted to be involved, that I think everyone knew that this trial was going to gain lots of attention. So, hey, this would be a great way to promote my services, the Innocence Project, get funding for that. Like, there are reports that that was his thought from the beginning. And I think that's a super important point in terms of Barry Scheck, because I think the chapter is titled The Best Trial. Yep, The Best Trial Lawyer is chapter 18, talking about Barry Scheck. It's not the race card. It's, hey, he is a brilliant thinking, scientific white man, very consistent with that black people are emotional, conniving, you said, and white people are logical, scientific, thinking, plotting. Very important. Consistent themes in the system. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up. Launch should be. I guess I'll ask too, because we're in the middle of a pandemic. We just had the election and the terrorism. I will make sure. What are people learning from this book in terms of how is this helpful towards solving racism, white supremacy, or even relevant to, you know, February 4, 2021, where we have boundless problems? Why in the world do we even need to chat about O.J. Simpson and Mark G.E.D. Furman? Make sure we get that response as we move along. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Can I hear it?
Mo, our caller in California. Yes, sir.
Greetings, guests. Greeting, callers. This is 0526. I just wanted to comment on, I'm learning a lot of, from this text, the racist logic that manifests in the words that the racists use. Something caught my ear when I was listening. I don't know if I think it's two men are saying that OJ materialized out of somewhere or whatever, and it's like it's the racist logic of racist man and racist woman projecting onto black people being evil magical creatures who could so-called materialize. I don't think people materialize. I think ghosts may materialize in movies and whatnot, but I don't think people materialize out of nowhere like he described. So I think that caught my ear. I don't know if it caught anyone else's ear, but that's my only comment for now. Thanks for listening.
Much obliged, sir. I thought that was important as well. And that is a pattern. I think I've talked before. He was talking about the defense, Johnny Cochran, going to Red's point, too, that is something conniving about black people. They're not intelligent and smart. He said that the defense, they conjured a scheme to try to acquit O.J. Simpson. And then later, he said that it was magic. Johnny Cochran was doing some sort of, and I said that had, to me, it sounded very similar to he's got some sort of black magic, conjuring spells and voodoo, all the rest of it. And then O.J. Simpson materialized. Oh, and then he had said earlier, he said that the defense, they spooked the prosecution about the knife incident, the spook who sat by the door. And that was a racial slur, calling black people spooks at one point. So lots of the same type of imagery. And that would be the man not too. There's something, they're just spooks and, you know, ghosts and all the rest, not people. Much obliged, sir. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard? Can I be?
Heard both of you. I think I heard Mo in Dallas first. We'll start there.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Carla, for yielding. Thank you guys for the program. Starting with the O.J. Simpson, I'm noticing in this particular reading a lot of confirmation bias. Like how earlier on in the book, O.J. Simpson is a murderous, just imbecile, if you will, who's illiterate, you know, who can't do anything correctly if you pay attention. And then later on, like in I think in chapter 13, he threatened Shapiro over wearing his blue ribbon in support of the authorities, it just doesn't make sense, you know. If you're following logic, like how would someone so ignorant pick up on things like this and be able to practice as their own, you know, counsel? You know, I can understand how if you didn't have, or if you wanted to believe either one of those things, that this book, you know, if he wanted to believe that O.J. Simpson was an imbecile or a genius, like this book promotes both of those ideas in some regard. The witnesses, Mark Furman being a suave media darling, you know, smart and a sex symbol, if you will, and how he was, you know, ended up being tripped up by questioning by F. Lee Bailey, you know, and I thought that was interesting. And Kato Kaelin, you know, was a freeloader, you know, and uneducated, and Marsha Clark could not corner him on questioning. Like I find that like just amazing. Like it is, especially if she is so, you know, she has a 90% conviction rate. How is she not able to get clear answers out of a witness? You know, like it's very confusing. Like especially if you're listening or reading this book, you know, with any sort of logic, period. Another thing about Marsha Clark, this was, I think, last week's reading. It's just a quick one. How I believe she in the 90s was, I think the book stated that she was making 90-something thousand dollars a year, and she needed, like, she didn't have proper child care. That was also very confusing, you know? Like, how are you, how do you have so much money and not be able to afford a babysitter? Like, I don't make nearly as much, and I'm still, like, able to procure a babysitter. Like, there's a lot of things in this book that are just confusing. Like I said, when you're using logic, that's all I have on my line.
Use logic. Use logic. That is what white people do not want us to do. And I would submit anyone who uses a lot of deception, they are trying to short circuit your ability to use logic. They can be all right with you taking any sort of position. OJ did it. He didn't do it. Just use logic. This is what happened. I don't have to lie about anything. I can just present accurate information and follow logic, come to a logical conclusion. It should stand out when people are not able to do that. Rob in California should be with us as well.
Might be heard.
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings to Gus and the callers and listeners. I have 3 points that I want to make. First point, I did not know that Mark Furman was a high school dropout. It doesn't surprise me, being from the city and state of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We had a governor, Mr. Scott Walker, who attained the title of governor, and he didn't have a college degree. So I think that really highlights that under this system that we live under, credentials for people that are classified as white isn't that important. Second point, the relevance to studying the O.J. Simpson trial right now. I would just point to a statement that Mr. Simpson made. I'm not black. I'm O.J. And I think that this case highlights that, you know, no matter what status that you achieve under this system, if you're classified as non-white, more specifically classified as a black male and or female, your status that you achieve can quote-unquote be ripped white from under you. It doesn't mean anything. And the third point that I would like to make, I remember tuning in to the first couple of sessions on this reading, and the question was proposed that we believe if OJ did it or not. So in 1995, I was 14 years old, and when you asked that question, my answer to the question was no. Like, as a child, I didn't believe that he did it, but I didn't understand why I took that perspective until I was listening to another Kyle's program, and the movie Founder was brought up. And that brought me back to my fifth grade teacher. I would like to shout out Miss Ross, and she sold us the movie Founder in the fifth grade, and she also showed us the movie's Eyes on the Prize, and that started to shape my perspective on people that are classified as white and how people classified as black were treated under this system. And thank you for taking my call.
Shout to Miss Ross. Thank you, Rob, in California. The late, great Cicely Tyson, the late Paul Whitfield, who is also in The Terminator, and White Dog co-stars in Sounder. Whew. Wow. Terminator, White Dog, and Sounder. Woof, my goodness. Two out of three we have already discussed in detail on the cows, in the book club, even no less. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Be in Santa Rosa, yes, sir.
Hey, how you doing today? I just got one thing I really want to say is how incompetent Marsha Clark is. Like what the last caller said, she couldn't even say anything to Mark Fuhrman. She couldn't get him to do anything. She shows up late. And she didn't it say she missed 3 months. I don't have the book. Recording say she missed 3 months?
He didn't do any direct questioning for about 3 months. She was not the one that was questioning the witnesses for about 3 months. Oh. Yes.
And why is that? Like, you know, I didn't see the trial online yet or anything like that, but why isn't she doing anything and everybody else is doing something? Is she the incompetent one? And that's all.
She had her divorce and dental issues, that sort of thing. I think also in her book, I'll read a little bit from her book, but she does say that their strategy, they wanted to attempt to make a connection with the jurors. I might just read it, but that's the gist of it. They wanted to connect as opposed to having her question one day and then Darden question one day and then Bill Hodgman questioned one day and Sherry Lou, blah, 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 to stick with Marsha Clark for 2 or 3 months, stick with Darden for 2 or 3 months, because Darden started everything. He was the one that was questioning Rosa Lopez. He was the one that questioned Nicole Brown Simpson, or Denise Brown, some of the early witnesses. That was all Darden. So they wanted to try to let each person take a turn. Let's see. Affirmative action. That was mentioned last week. One of our... Did you have more?
That sounds kind of crazy. Oh, I'm sorry. All right, that's it.
For sure.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Thomas in New York. This is not the Apollo or Deaf Comedy Jam. Can we please refrain from bad jokes and or anti-black humor? Thank you kindly.
I
Oh, okay. I can't say I learned anything other than tiny details. What this book did offer me was confirmation, because no one can have convinced me after I watched the case live that he did it. But it shows the continuous power, or the power of continuous propaganda, because so many other people over the years have changed their position on his innocence due to that. But still, no motive, no intent, no murder weapon, no witnesses, no investigation of any other suspects. So they put themselves at a deficit. Furman, he looks like an actor named Paul Gleason to me. This guy's been in a lot of movies. How could Darton not look at Furman's record and not figure out why he was the why having a black prosecutor on this case was paramount to the state? His role should have been obvious to himself at that point. You have a racist cop, and you have who's notorious for putting cops on trial. Three community colleges and no associate's degree. Now that, like you said, that sounds like a dumb jock. You know, Trayvon went to three community colleges before getting a tryout for the Seattle Seahawks. You know, it sounds like the backstory to a black athlete. But yet this guy becomes a police officer and makes it all the way up to detective. You know, sort of like Bob Costas. You know, we find out Bob Costas wasn't even qualified, you know. Effie Bailey, I think he got a thrill out of using the word nigger and getting away with it. He really put a strong emphasis on that R. How did Marsha Clark not have Furman more prepared? She had to know his record as well. She had to know this was going to be a problem. You're facing Johnny Cochran. They're using racism as their defense. Why would you not have this guy better prepared? Bailey's style, he would ask the same question in several different ways. It was like an employment test. Like, then I answer this question, but, you know, I think he's in his way of giving you no chance to go back or change your story. And I believe if Marsha Clark could have put O.J. on O.J.'s trial together without using Mark Furman, she would have. But he was the lead detective and the founder of the glove. Shapiro, distancing himself, he didn't want to include race. In a case where your client's on trial for murder, double homicide, and a racist cop just happens to be the person who's the first on the scene and found the critical evidence, you don't want to use race. Shapiro, nothing more than a deal maker, the ambulance chaser. He's yet to present any defense for his client. We've seen Cochran, Bailey, Sheck, Neufeld, Dershowitz. They've all earned their check so far. And it seems like Shapiro got paid to do nothing. Barry Sheck was the best lawyer I ever witnessed. I know it's no knock on Johnny Cochran. Johnny Cochran, much better litigator. But he was like a lawyer and a teacher at the same time, explaining in plain language to the jury and the people at home watching exactly what DNA was and how it worked, because it was fairly new. And he attacked the police in every way possible. After he finished, the LAPD was a total laughingstock. And that lasted for like a weekend. He opened the policy book of evidence collection and pointed out every breach in policy in a meticulous way that they made. He went through the blood collection process and showed how they messed up the DNA collection process and how they didn't follow that. He knew more about the procedures than the cops and the science experts. And he took every shred of evidence and tied it to the cops, showed how they messed it up. The blood photos, he showed the photos of the gate picture from a week earlier with the blood was not on the gate. So where did this blood come from? Was it planted? Yeah, so when I watched the case, after he was done, it was like it was over. I was really thinking they would just throw it out. I think he won the case. He took O.J. off of trial and put the police on trial. He left so much reasonable doubt concerning the conspiracy that LAPD and therefore the prosecution was framing O.J., planting evidence, planting gloves, planting blood. That blood evidence was finished. They brought in their experts. I remember that. And this guy was explaining, and this is why I said Sheck was so good. Sheck already explained it. This guy was so confusing. He was trying to use all of the big words and, you know, really lost everyone. But that was all because it was all that evidence was already discredited. So they tested the blood in the sock. It passed this. Well, that's blood that you guys already poured on the sock. You know, it was very damning, as they would say. And last thing, they showed the video of someone collecting blood and then use the same glove, put their hands in a swab thing, and then collect another sample of blood with the same glove. Like, all of this is just totally against procedure. And we always say procedures and policy. He destroyed them on that. I mute my line. Thank you.
Policy and procedure, neutralizing workplace racism, every Friday. That comes up once, a dozen times each broadcast. Policy and procedure. And there are many, many, many breaches of policy and procedure on the part of the LAPD, their criminologists, their detectives. Many, many. One is only left to speculate. Why would we have so many breaches of policy and procedure? And at minimum, if you have an environment where you have a lot of people who are not adhering to policy and procedure, you certainly don't have to have everyone being a racist, but someone who is about deception and practicing racism would thrive in that environment, because we're kind of sloppy and inaccurate, imprecise about how we do things anyway. At minimum, which they could have said. I'll hush there. Let's see. We have people who wrote in, and I want to give a little bit of background, because Marsha Clark does have some interesting commentary on this, as well as Mr. Cochran, and people wrote in. So I'll start with some of the folks who wrote in. So our caller last week, female victim of racism, she said that Marsha Clark is the example of affirmative action. We got more this week, her being linked to court and then sometimes not being present at all, and the divorce excuse, child care problems, dental problems, all the rest of it. Affirmative action, wham, poor white woman. So our listener, she wrote back in this week. She says, please do continue with the background reading. It provides a very useful context and confirms just how much of a liar Jeffrey Toobin really is. You asked what I meant by describing Jeffrey Toobin's bitchy drag queen quality. I worked around several effeminate gay men, a couple of whom are drag queens in their spare time. They continuously throw insults, and some of their comments are so quick you can miss them. That's how Toobin's narrative comes across to me. It's not just the distinct, clearly racist way he refers to all non-white people involved in the O.J. Simpson case. Yes, he writes in a way to bias the reader against O.J. Simpson, but this doesn't require the level of insults he includes in pretty much every sentence about a non-white person. He is clearly full of envy, but there is also a sexual undertone which comes across to me when he is describing Johnny Cochran. One of the callers stated he felt there was a sexual undertone to the way Toobin described Mark Furman. Oh, yeah. And I agree. I suspected Jeffrey Toobin has been up to more than just Zoom bombing in his private life. I continue to watch the trial. I'm at the beginning of May, so she's way past us. We're in April. So I've watched Mark Furman's first appearance on the stand. He wrote that Marsha Clark said he was the best witness she had seen. I'm not surprised. Not only has he been coached, but he is clearly a psychopath. Just the wisdom of psychopaths. Kevin Dutton. in the archives. A number, if not all, of the police lied when they gave evidence. Yep, even on the search warrant, they are what's called professional witnesses. It's a core requirement of their job. However, they were clearly coached by the prosecution lawyers, even though they did show their emotions at points. Mark Furman stands out because he is eerily calm and provides an incredible level of detail without faltering. Again, watching his testimony is a must. I cannot emphasize that enough. Just GED high school dropout is on the stand. I'm not surprised to find out Marsha Clark is an alcoholic, has an eating disorder, and comes from a dysfunctional home. Her behavior in the courtroom moves from overly emotional, disrespectful of Judge Ito's request for the lawyers to conduct themselves professionally, to being flirty with the male lawyers and Judge Ito in an attempt to get her own way. F. Lee Bailey did say that when he was on the program. He said she flirted with all the guys in the courtroom. Johnny Cochran is criticized by feminists for not falling for her lie about child care arrangements, but there's no criticism of Marsha Clark for her sexually demeaning comment to F. Lee Bailey. Question. Instead, Judge Ito's management of the courtroom was said to be the problem, and she did not apologize to F. Lee Bailey as Judge Ito requested. Listen to her words. She brags about not apologizing in her book. I do not believe Christopher Darden, nigga please, is that deluded about his role in the trial to counter Johnny Cochran and be the blackface of the mistreatment of O.J. Simpson. I think his ego is driving him to believe that he was selected because race soldiers thought he was a good lawyer. He is a victim. I said that was all I could conclude was victim. Finally, I think it's important to remind ourselves as the book reading continues that the prosecution was initially seeking the death penalty for O.J. Simpson. Gil Garcetti was the lead prosecutor. That absolutely was something that they were discussing. The local NAACP and other groups, they had meetings with Garcetti and the prosecutors to discourage them from pursuing the death penalty, which he shouldn't have gotten anyway, because even if he did do this, this was his first offense. Should have been life in prison, no parole. That's what it should have been, no death penalty. All right, let's hear Marsha Clark. She says, when F. Lee Bailey approached the witness, he couldn't resist jabbing the bamboo under our nails. Let me give you one more. Just the metaphors. Pay attention to the metaphors. Much of the civilized world tuned in to catch the opening day of Bailey's cross-examination of Mark Furman. That's just what Bailey had hoped for. For weeks now, he'd been pounding his chest and blustering to the media how he would do the most annihilating, character-assassinating cross-examination ever. Now millions of viewers were dangling over the walls of the virtual Coliseum in eager anticipation of a bloodbath. When Bailey approached the witness, he couldn't resist jabbing the bamboo under our nails. Can you tell us when it was that you were enlightened to the fact that plastic you saw in Mr. Simpson's Bronco comes with the car? I believe it was Saturday, Mark replied. So after 9 months of investigation, you discovered on Saturday that this important piece of evidence was perfectly innocuous. Is that right? Ouch. I'm pausing here just because there are lots of reports. That's 9 months where people were saying, ooh, O.J. Simpson had a shovel in the back of his car. Ooh, he had plastic wrap. He was going to take the bodies out and bury them in the woods. Ooh, like there are serious reports, right? People that are saying this to get 9 months in. Oh, this is standard issue in all the Broncos. Oh, he used the shovel as a pooper scooper for the dog, not burying dead white bodies. But for 9 months, you had people say, oh my God, he was going to bury Nicole. Continuing. Ouch. I have to say that I found myself admiring Bailey's style. Unlike every other member of the Dream Team who tended to meander and become mired in meaningless detail, Bailey kept his cross on course. I enjoyed watching him as I had enjoyed watching no other member of that defense. There was a glimmer of real lawyering here. Yikes. Continuing, let's see. Next one. All right, so this is when the whole nigger part. Have you used that word in the past 10 years? Object, Chris hissed at me. This was the guy who was going to treat Furman as a hostile witness, right? Now he's pushing me to run interference. But I couldn't object again. I knew that very question had been asked of Mark by our side in the grand jury room session. If so, Bailey could make a fool of me if I spoke up. Why would Miss Clark object to the very question that the prosecution themselves posed to Detective Furman? My objection would make me look like a liar and a racist myself, like I was trying to hide whatever offensive remarks Furman had given to us. A quick glance at the jury told me we couldn't afford to be overruled on any more objections about race. They were glaring at me with hatred. They wanted to hear Furman's answers. Let's see. She's saying silently she doesn't believe that he has not said nigger. She's wishing that he just, you know, maybe I said it once or twice and, you know, I was young and ignorant, that type of thing. Let's see. Next. Okay. Let's see. I'll give you. So she includes, she writes down or jots down some of the recordings from her car tape in her book. So I'm including a little bit of that. So this is the car tape transcribed from March 15. Mark Furman's been on the stand for almost a week now, but he's holding his own pretty well. We may have gotten to the end of cross, and I think right now Chris and I are at odds about whether or not to do redirect. I wanted to not do any, which would really kind of send a nice message that he hasn't been hurt. I'm really torn about this. In the meantime, I get all these outrageous offers to be on all these television shows. I think I'll just quit the case and do it. Oh God, I really hate this. I feel so alone. I feel like I have 3 feet of vacuum around me everywhere I go. I don't feel like anybody can penetrate it. End of car tape. When Mark Furman finally stepped down after 6 days on the stand, he was almost universally hailed as the victor in a grudge match against Bailey. The press showered him with praise. Cops and civilians alike sent him flowers, gifts, and baskets of food. The LAPD offered up a cake for him, and they celebrated alongside the deputies and the law clerks in the war room. I was in no mood for rejoicing. The last place I wanted to be was at a party for Mark Furman. I sent my regrets. Mark Furman's testimony had taken its toll on my spirits. I'd always prided myself on my clinical focus. Even as I waded hip-deep through mud and blood, I could count on my discipline and detachment to serve as barriers against the ugliness. But sitting for days in that courtroom, hearing Bailey bellow, "Nigger," had driven my morale to an all-time low. Chris had been right when he argued against the admissibility of the N-word back in January. No decent person can hear that word without feeling a shock down the spine. If it inspired revulsion in me, I could only imagine what it inspired in the jurors. Let's see, I think... yes, I'll stop there. I'll give a little bit of Johnny Cochran, and then we'll get in audio segment two. Let's see. So Johnny Cochran, Journey to Justice, 292, he writes, so at first he's talking about wanting to question Mark or cross-examine Mark Furman himself, but he decides against, obviously. But I also knew this case was about O.J. Simpson and not about me. No matter how great a sense of satisfaction I might have gained by exposing Mark Furman to the world, what mattered was that O.J. Simpson's jury saw. And what really mattered about Furman was the fact that he was a liar. If he was willing to perjure himself about his bigotry, then clearly he was willing to testify falsely about other things. things like blood and gloves. Credibility, not race, was the issue in this cross-examination, and it was critical that we maintain that focus so that it could be communicated to the jury. The best way to do that, I was convinced, was to confront Furman with a white lawyer. So I put my history and my feelings aside and turned over the witness I'd wanted to confront all my life to Lee Bailey. I'm not sure I've ever made a more difficult decision, nor been more certain that I was right. Lee Bailey's cross-examination of Furman was almost as widely panned as it was misunderstood. Lee's sense of courtroom theater may occur occasionally lurch uncomfortably close to melodrama, but on this occasion, he knew exactly what he had to accomplish. It is also worth noting, by the way, that while the commentators scoffed at Bailey's performance that day, the jurors subsequently told us they loved it. He was just like a lawyer in the movies, one of them later said with obvious pleasure. More important, he did just what O.J. Simpson's defense required him to do. Playing on Furman's arrogance and obvious disdain, Bailey danced him around until he stated two things without qualification. He had never spoken the word nigger in the past 10 years, and he had never planted evidence. Do you use the word? Blah, 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 blah. We already heard that. Testimony. Okay. It would be months before we would discover screenwriter Laura Hart McKinney's tape-recorded conversations with Furman, and even longer before the jurors would hear the detective impeach himself in his own voice. Never mind. We'll get to that later. But the truth was, it really did not matter. I said the same thing, but we'll see about that later. Lee Bailey had accomplished what our client required of him, and if the pundits missed it, the jurors did not, as several of them told us after the trial. They never believed Furman. I could tell by the way he twisted around in his seat and clenched his hands in his lap that he was lying. Armanda Cooley, the forewoman, I think she's one of the ones in Madam Forewoman that Red in Ohio was talking about, I think she's a co-author, would tell us, from her vantage point in the first seat of the jury box's front row, she had seen all she needed to see. It was Lee's finest moment in the trial. A few days later, Shapiro, a blue ribbon signifying support for the LAPD, wistfully fixed to his lapel, cross-examined Phil Van Netter. Deferential, though he may have been to a veteran of a department whose goodwill he was desperate to retain, Bob nonetheless extracted two absolutely key facts from Van Netter. On the early morning of June 13, he had spent far more time at the Rockingham estate from which Simpson then was absent than he had at the Bundy Drive condo where two people lay murdered. The only reasonable inference to be drawn from that was that Van Netter had already fixed on Simpson as the primary suspect. Moreover, when Simpson's blood sample was taken at Parker Center later that day, Van Netter did not book it into evidence as required by procedure. Instead, he placed it in his pocket, where it remained for the next 3 hours until he turned it over to LAPD criminalist Dennis Fung back at Rockingham. The significance of that inexplicable interval would shortly loom still larger when it emerged that LAPD could not account for all the blood its nurse had taken from Simpson that afternoon. How much of it had disappeared during those mysterious 3 hours, and where had it gone? If every trial is some sense a drama, then I suppose it must have interludes of comic relief. Cato Kalin was ours. Many adjectives have been employed to describe America's most celebrated house guests. Perhaps feckless would be the kindest. He told Mark Furman one story about O.J.'s demeanor and movements on the night of the murders and about the mysterious thumps he claimed to have heard in the passageway where the Rockingham glove was found. On the stand, he said other things, leading Marsha Clark, at Judge Ito's suggestion, to have him declared a hostile witness.
Later, in other forums, he told other stories. His only real purpose seemed to be to make sure nobody was mad at him, no matter what that might cost other people, including OJ, from whom he had been freeloading. At one point, while Cato was on the stand, I leaned over to OJ and inquired, "Simpson, why in the world did you let this person live at your house?" Excellent question. "Look," he said, shaking his head, "I was just easygoing. I didn't think it was appropriate for him to live in the same condo with Nicole and the kids, so I just sort of let him stay at the house." It may not have been entirely fair, but somehow Cato and Shapiro began to merge in my mind. That's interesting. When the prosecutors called LAPD criminalist Dennis Fung and Andrea Mazzola to the stand, they surely must have anticipated that they would be on and off in a matter of hours. Of course, at that point, they had not dealt with Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, nor, I think, were they entirely clear on just how serious a challenge we intended to mount on LAPD's scandalously slipshod methods of collecting and analyzing the sort of scientific evidence with which they were attempting to convict O.J. Simpson. More than a week later, they could have no doubt. Scheck's meticulously prepared, relentlessly pursued cross-examination of Fung is one of the most brilliant courtroom performances I have ever witnessed. Using their own manuals, reports, and even crime scene videos, Scheck impeached Fung and Neufeld impeached Mazzola on their lack of training, their fidelity to their department's own procedures, and their collection, preservation, and handling of evidence. Barry used their own notes and crime scene videos not only to show them contaminating evidence, but also to contradict Van Natter's account of how Simpson's blood sample had been transferred to the criminalists. As it turned out, that crucial reference sample, after hours in the detective's possession, had just been tossed into a plastic garbage bag with other key items of evidence, then left to sit on the front seat of the criminalist's truck. Scheck's cross-examination was so devastating that I would not be surprised if, on his deathbed, the last thing Dennis Fung hears is the sound of Barry Scheck demanding, "What about that, Mr. Fung?" Ito clearly shared my assessment. At one point late in the process, he called us to a sidebar conference. "He's like a deer caught in the headlights," he said of the criminalist. "When are you going to let him go, Mr. Scheck?" Let's see, do I need to win one more or read one more? I'll stop there. I'll stop there. The last little tidbit I will share, this is a news report. I just thought it was revealing because this is from Live Time, and it's talking about the criminologists, Mazzola and Fung. What was being reported live time. So this is the O.J. Simpson murder trial, the L.A. Times. This is their home base. So they covered this trial pretty much like no other. So way back April 27, 1995, and they're talking about Mazzola and Fung's testimony, and they have a panel of legal experts. And so they come in and dissect whatever happened that day on the trial. So they're talking about Mazzola and Fung's performance at up to this point in April. So Brian Lysaght, L-Y-S-A-G-H-T, he writes, "The prosecution is not driving its case forward with aggression and precision. It is engaging in damage control and losing. Mazzola is starting to get that deer in the headlights look. Goldberg's role has been reduced to cleaning up after Barry Scheck, Peter Neufeld, New York parade. If this is a harbinger of DNA evidence days to come, the prosecution case should be taken off the grill. It's done." He also wrote insight about the defense. "Neufeld took too long, but he further eroded the prosecution's version of what happened with Simpson's blood vial. In August, Mazzola," this is August 94, "Mazzola said she was with Fung all the time. But Wednesday, she said she had to do some back and fill. Mazzola said she was briefly in another room with her eyes closed on Simpson's couch, making it possible for Fung to put the bio in the garbage bag without her seeing it. It's getting curiouser and curiouser. That phrasing is used in the FX series. I will stop there. That's our extras for today. Let's see. I think missed one caller. I'll nab out one caller and then we'll scoot to the audio segment. Let's see. Our victim in Canada. Did you have commentary, sir?
Yes, sir. I want to say hi to the cow's guest and thank you, Gus. I just wanted to, well, as I was listening to the audio, I was thinking how the suspected white supremacists or race soldiers, they always speak in terms of code. They not only have like a they have a code that doesn't produce justice. Deception is used and it hurts non-white people, but they speak in code. They use words to conceal their true intentions. And therefore that is indirect violence. Indirect violence is deception. So it's not just, there's two forms of violence. There's direct violence and indirect violence, and deception is indirect violence. So they use codes of how they speak, and they use words that don't really clearly reveal truth. So I remember last week when we were on the book club, I heard the word crab apple. And that's sort of like another term to describe non-white people. And that's kind of what I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
Much obliged to our victim in Canada. We will pause there. Make sure we have anybody that we missed totally. You will get a chance to share, and anyone who has extra comments, the books that we heard, anything else, we'll get your comments also. We'll get our second audio segment in right now. Jeffrey Toobin, The Run of His Life, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment 2.
The length and complexity of the DNA testimony pushed the trial toward a kind of giddy exhaustion. Though Ito had originally told jurors the case might end in February, the marathon now appeared headed well into the summer. The principals coped. During Fung's testimony, Marcia Clark changed her perm to a more natural hairstyle, a much-admired transformation that landed her hairdresser on Oprah. Darden, meanwhile, seethed in quiet frustration, his distress compounded because his beloved older brother Michael, a former drug addict, lay dying of AIDS near their hometown of Richmond. Every hour in court was time that could have been spent with him. Cochran, cheerful as always, read his office mail as the other lawyers droned. Ito floundered. Courtroom discipline fluctuated according to the judge's press clippings. When, as happened periodically, a big story in the Los Angeles Times or one of the networks chided him for letting the case drag on, the judge would snap to attention for a day or two, refusing to hold sidebars and generally pushing things along. His resolve would then fade until the next critical story. After Newsweek put Ito's picture on the cover under the headline, "What a Mess?", the judge lashed back at the press by permanently evicting two reporters from the courtroom, ostensibly for talking. Gail Holland of USA Today and Kristen Jeanette Myers of Court TV paid the price for Ito's pique. When the New York Times published a hostile editorial entitled "Banker's Hours for the O.J. Case," Ito lengthened the court day. Fundamentally, though, nothing much changed. The families of the victims dealt with the stress in strikingly different manners. For many months, the Goldman family simply bore witness at the trial and said little in public. Denise Brown used the occasion of the trial to embrace the cause of domestic violence. She and her family created the Nicole Brown Simpson Charitable Foundation, devoted to the issue of spousal abuse. It was launched at a press conference at the Rainbow Room in New York, sponsored by No Excuses Sportswear, best known previously for some scandal-scarred spokeswomen, among them Donna Rice, Marla Maples, and Paula Jones. As the first president of the foundation, the Brown family named Jeff C. Noble, a 40-year-old Dallas businessman who was awaiting sentencing for lying to federal authorities in a savings and loan scam, and who had been named in a domestic violence restraining order for posing a clear and present danger to his estranged wife and two children. Noble stepped down when these facts about his past became public. Chapter 19. Stockholm Syndrome. Their greatest humiliation, the jurors remembered later, came right before bed. At 11 o'clock every night, one of the deputy sheriffs would walk around the fifth floor of the Intercontinental Hotel, knock on the jurors' doors, and demand their room keys. This ceremony went on every night for months before anyone even asked about it. This was how the jurors behaved, trusting, accepting, even passive about the many embarrassments of their quasi-custodial living arrangements. Finally, someone worked up the nerve to ask why they had to surrender their keys for the 6.5 hours until the deputies returned to wake them up. "It's so you don't go into each other's rooms," the sheriff's spokesman replied. That was that. The jurors were to be trusted to decide whether O.J. Simpson murdered two human beings, but not to sleep with the keys to their own rooms. As usual, there was no protest, and the jurors continued to yield the keys until their last night in confinement. As with so many petty insults, the jurors lived with this one, too. By summer, they were struggling. 12 jurors and 12 alternates had reported for sequestration under the 24-hour-a-day supervision of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department on January 11th. With the exception of occasional weekend outings, a much-enjoyed group ride on a blimp, a disastrous boat ride to Catalina Island, on which almost everyone got seasick, the jurors' world was circumscribed by the courthouse and the Intercontinental, about a mile away. Their rooms had no telephones or televisions. Deputy sheriffs dialed and monitored all telephone calls from a central telephone room and screened newspapers for references to the case, clipping them out. Blockbuster supplied an unending stream of movies for the pair of video rooms, dubbed Cinema One and Cinema Two by Judge Ito. The jurors ate their meals as a group. One night a week, from 7 o'clock to midnight, the jurors were allowed unsupervised conjugal visits with their spouses or significant others. Not surprisingly, these arrangements produced immediate and lasting stresses on the jurors. The strain showed itself in trivial ways. Like summer campers, or more relevant, prisoners everywhere, the jurors complained about the food. As Armanda Cooley, who eventually became foreperson, once put it in a meeting with the judge, "Same thing, repetitious, too many particles walking, crawling, talking in the food." Movie selection produced enduring tensions, as did movie-watching behavior. Ito devoted a great deal of time to mediating between jurors who wanted to talk and those who preferred silence during the videos. The alleged foot odor of one juror, Tracy Kennedy, was another problem. There was also what Judge Ito bemusedly referred to as the famous Target/Ross shopping incident, which involved one juror's complaint that one group of jurors had an hour to shop at the Ross discount store and 30 minutes at a Target Emporium, whereas other jurors had only a half hour at each. The aggrieved shopper was Jeanette Harris, a 38-year-old African-American employment interviewer and a divisive force on the jury from the first day. In light of Harris's answers during voir dire, it was bewildering that the prosecutors had left her on the jury at all. When Clark asked Harris about the low-speed Bronco chase on June 17th, Harris said, "My family is comprised mostly of males, so I know that females have this real desire, you know, to protect their young men. My heart just went out." Asked about Simpson's plea of no contest to domestic violence charges in 1989, Harris said, I guess if I was a celebrity, there probably would be times when I would say no contest, because the media is so vicious. Less than a month after the jurors were sequestered, Harris put Ito and the lawyers on notice that tensions were brewing among the jurors over something much more important than videos. In a secret closed-door session on February 7th, just a few days into the taking of testimony, Harris told them that the jury was splintering along racial lines. Harris had requested the meeting ostensibly to complain about the famous shopping incident and her difficulties with another juror. She said the deputies had intentionally given the white jurors the extra half hour to shop at Ross while hurrying the black jurors through the store. Harris also asserted, improbably enough, that she had been pushed by Catherine Murdoch, a 63-year-old white legal secretary, and only the first of several jurors Harris would accuse of striking her. "In the last week or so, there has been like a major division," Harris said in the judges' chambers. Meal tables had become segregated by race, with Murdoch at a table with all the white jurors and anybody that is not African-American. Shocked by the accusation, Murdoch denied any malign intent, and Ito believed her. Nevertheless, the very existence of the accusation put everyone on notice about just how fragile the jury was. A full-fledged crisis was averted because Murdoch was removed from the jury on February 7th for an unrelated reason. Her arthritis doctor, who also treated Simpson, had been listed as a defense witness, though he never testified. Several other jurors also left the case in the early weeks, one because she was found to have covered up a history of domestic violence, another because he worked for Hertz and had apparently met Simpson. After Murdoch, Michael Knox was dismissed on March 1st for failing to report that he had been arrested for kidnapping a former girlfriend. Next came Tracy Kennedy, who was removed on March 17th because Ito believed he was keeping notes for a book. Both Knox and Kennedy did manage to parlay their brief tenure as jurors into books. But it was Jeanette Harris who continued to absorb the attention of lawyers on both sides. In March, the judge received an anonymous letter suggesting that Harris had been a long-term victim of domestic violence. Sheriff's deputies followed up on the lead, and they learned that in 1988, Harris had sought a restraining order against her husband. In voir dire and in her questionnaire, Harris had specifically denied any personal involvement with domestic violence. The prosecutors wanted her off the jury, asserting that she had lied during the course of jury selection. The defense lawyers wanted Harris to remain, arguing that her answers during voir dire amounted only to innocent mistakes. In the argument over Harris, Ito made a revealing observation. "The one thing that's interesting to me is that, were one to look at this case in the abstract, and what we have here, it would seem to me that the defense would want her off in the worst way, that the prosecution would want to keep her. And I see the diametrically opposed position." Ito was probably being coy, for by this point in the trial, he knew how much race had trumped gender. The defense wanted to keep a black juror, even if she had been abused by her husband. Through all the jury controversies, the one constant was the prosecution wanting to shed black jurors, the defense seeking to evict whites. In any event, on April 5th, Ito dismissed Harris for her lack of candor about the domestic violence in her past, and she, in turn, promptly created an uproar in the case. Pat Harvey, an anchorwoman at KCAL, a local television station in Los Angeles, had a dentist who had been teasing her with some tantalizing information during the first several months of the trial. He said he had a patient who was a juror in the Simpson case, but he wouldn't tell Harvey her name. When Harris was dismissed, the dentist confided that she was the patient, and he arranged for the ex-juror to sit for an interview with Harvey. In the conversation conducted on April 5th, just hours after Harris was dismissed, Jeanette Harris sat with Harvey in the co-anchor's chair and shared her impressions of the trial so far. Jeanette Harris was, it turned out, the prosecution's worst nightmare. "From day one, I didn't see it as being a fair trial," Harris told Harvey. Prosecutors, she asserted, were saying a whole lot of nothing. She accused Denise Brown of acting on the witness stand, just as Johnny Cochran had predicted the black jurors would react. Harris said she believed that Mark Furman was capable of probably anything, including planting evidence. As for the defendant himself, Harris said that she was quite impressed with Simpson and his ability to handle his grief. "It amazes me. It totally amazes me that he handles things as well as he does." Even worse than her pro-defense interpretation of the evidence was Harris's suggestion that the racial tension surrounding the case might influence jurors' votes. "There is maybe a person that, say, one of the Caucasians will say, 'I can't vote him not guilty because when I walk out of here, I want to walk back into a life,'" Harris told Harvey. "Or an African-American might say, 'I can't say he's guilty because I want to walk out of here.' You know, those things cross your mind. In other words, jurors might vote to please their racial group. In addition, there was no doubt in Harris's mind that the sheriff's department was promoting racial divisions on the jury. There are racial problems, and the deputies, some of them, not to badmouth the sheriff's department, but some of them are promoting it. Worst of all, as Harris told a reporter for KCAL off camera, jurors were discussing the facts of the case among themselves, in clear violation of Judge Ito's orders to them. Harris's conduct was reprehensible. She had lied about her past to get on the jury. Once seated, she viewed the evidence with a completely biased eye in favor of the defense. How, after all, could this have been an unfair trial from day one? She admitted to being influenced by outside political pressures, and then she either lied about jurors discussing the case or failed to bring this misconduct to Ito's attention when the violation of his orders was occurring. In retrospect, it is hard to imagine how Harris could have done more to betray her oath as a juror. Yet Cochran knew just how to spin Harris's removal from the jury and her subsequent statements. The day after Harris's interview with Harvey, Cochran held an indignant news conference on the ground floor of the courthouse. But Cochran did not direct his indignation at Harris's misconduct. Rather, he asserted that the prosecution had undertaken a concerted effort to pick off jurors favorable to the defense. In a soundbite that was played repeatedly over the next few days, Cochran said, "We think that Big Brother is doing more than watching us. We're very concerned about this obsession to win." Cochran had once again posed the Simpson case as a contest between the black community and the white establishment. "If Mr. Simpson can't get a fair trial," Cochran told the reporters gravely, "then all of us would be in trouble." Faced with specific, unsolicited information about a juror, the sheriffs had investigated in an unobtrusive way by examining a court file. This inquiry had produced information establishing beyond doubt that Harris had lied on a critical issue in jury selection. She was, accordingly, dismissed as a juror. This, to Cochran, was evidence of a racist conspiracy against O.J. Simpson. That Cochran would make this absurd claim in an environment in which, according to Harris, information from the press was leaking through to jurors shows just how calculated a gesture it was. From the Todd Bridges trial to the Michael Jackson investigation, from the O.J. Simpson case to the civil suit filed by the white trucker Reginald Denny, Cochran found a handy white vendetta to denounce in every case, dreading, as always, the ordeal endured by Time magazine when it ran its darkened photo of Simpson on the cover, that is, being called racist. The mainstream press mostly reported Cochran's denunciations without comment. Jeanette Harris also dumped a major dilemma into Ito's lap. By asserting that jurors were discussing the case, Harris raised the troubling prospect of additional misconduct by the jury and the removal of more jurors. With only 6 alternates remaining, and likely months of testimony to go, this was a disheartening possibility for the judge, to say the least. But Ito felt he had to follow up. So after bringing Harris back in to flesh out her allegations, he decided to interview the remaining jurors in his chambers, one by one. For the lawyers, this was an extraordinary and rare opportunity to get a glimpse of the jurors and their state of mind in the middle of a trial. Merely conducting these inquiries unsettled the prosecution, because the judge's questions might raise the racial issue to jurors who may not have been affected by it. But as the jurors trooped through Ito's chambers during the 3rd week in April, it was clear that they had done plenty of thinking about race without Ito's help. The white jurors reacted to the racial issues with some hesitancy. Asked about racial tensions, Anise Aschenbach, a 60-year-old white woman, said, "Well, I don't know. Nothing has been said that I could pinpoint where that really is a problem, so I don't know." And several black jurors detected no animosity from anyone. Cochran never let up on his charm offensive, though, especially in the intimate setting of Ito's small office. One black juror took the opportunity in chambers to ask if the judge could get the jurors a copy of the movie Bad Boys, a thriller starring a pair of handsome young black actors. "Good movie," Cochran volunteered. The real news of these sessions was that several African-American jurors were furious, especially the men. That the black men were suffering was hardly surprising. Though it was not well known outside of Southern California, the Los Angeles sheriffs had a reputation for racism that matched that of the LAPD. Worse, the training for all deputy sheriffs involved a peculiar procedure that required new recruits, as their first assignment, to spend 2 years as guards at the LA County Jail. According to a widespread belief in Los Angeles, the sheriffs then spent the rest of their careers treating civilians like inmates. Since African-American men were disproportionately represented among the residents of the county jail, it is probably understandable that the black men on the jury chafed at the deputy's attitude at the hotel. Willie Craven, one of the black jurors, told Ito simply that some of the black jurors are treated like convicts. But Craven was a happy camper compared to Lon Cryer, a 43-year-old black telephone company employee. Cryer said he had been enraged one time when a female deputy told him to get off the patio of the hotel when she allowed several white jurors to remain. As a result, Cryer said, "I'm to the point where I don't really trust anybody involved here. I mean, no disrespect to you, Your Honor. I don't even trust you, sir. I mean, I don't trust anybody." The experience with the deputy, Cryer said, reminded him of some other things. "Tell me about that," Ito prompted. "About police, and well, I have no problems with police officers myself, but it kind of reminds me of why so many black men in America have such a problem with being confronted with white police officers in situations like when they are operating their cars, and they become very defensive about it. And it just kind of made me realize that those situations do exist. And you don't really have to be doing anything for them to take it upon themselves to be harassing toward you." One can scarcely imagine a monologue more likely to alienate the prosecutors in the case. But Clark and Darden made no effort to remove Cryer, and Ito completed his examination of the jurors without finding reason to dismiss any more of them. In the end, the notion of a prosecution conspiracy to eliminate hostile jurors was absurd. If anything, the prosecution probably should have been more aggressive in ferreting out the biases of potential and sitting jurors in the case. After all, several months later, on the day the verdict came in, it was Lon Cryer who showed his support for the defendant in the most dramatic way.
Context of white supremacy. That will wrap us for this week. We are still in Chapter 19, Stockholm Syndrome. Wowee. I don't know what type of memory you have. Certainly, Dr. Welsing students remember the Stockholm Syndrome, but this is the second book in a row we've read with a chapter titled Stockholm Syndrome. Cased 2. Fascinating. I will only add, there will be more to say about Mr. Cryer, Lon Cryer, C-R-Y-E-R. He is in the Court TV OJ 25 documentary. Wow. Anyone saying that old Lon Cryer, he was just, you know, caping for OJ Simpson, in there to support a black male, and was biased from the beginning. They had Lon Cryer on the OJ 25. He broke out his notes, and he had reams of notepads where he took very detailed notes about everything that took place in the trial. Mr. Lon Cryer, he's done other interviews as well, but just he's, I think, the only juror in the OJ 25 sequence. So you get to hear a lot of his commentary about many, many, many of the moments in the trial. In fact, he even had notes. One of the days O.J. Simpson had to come over, many times he had to come over and show his body to the jury, like the man not total like slavery type thing. But he has to come over one time to show his hands early in the trial. And he said that O.J. Simpson murmured, I want him to make sure that he gets a good look at my hands. And Mr. Cryer said it almost made him think like, wait a minute, does he think like I'm a black brother and I'm going to, you know, look him up, like, get out of here. Looking at the evidence, and it's just interesting to hear his and to hear him reading his notes to see kind of what he thought about different things. He talks in detail about Cato Kalin's testimony and when he got declared a hostile witness. We heard that today. The gloves, all the key moments, Mark Furman's testimony, all the big, you know, to do's. Mr. Cryer, he reads his notes and then he goes back and gives testimony or his reflections 25 years later. All right, so we'll get one of our other folks who wrote in, and then we'll get folks' final comment before we wrap up. So one of our other investors, he writes in chapter 17, in the past 10 years, Mr. Furman, whatever Mark Furman's character defects, it would have been sheer irrationality for him to plant the glove. What? Character defects? Furman wants to kill niggers, chokeholds for jaywalking, paints swastikas, etc. Tubin, you have got to be kidding me. Boldface print, exclamation point. Number two, Dershowitz. Many cops are trained to lie on the witness stand. I would love to ask Dershowitz about this statement. For sure. I've been trying to see if we can get him on the program, too. Number three, payment at the drive-through window. Simpson handed all the change back to Kalin. Simpson had tried to use Kalin to set up an alibi for premeditated murder. This seems like a weak argument to me. I'm so glad he brought that up, because I said the same thing. At minimum, if you could show that they didn't go to McDonald's at all, then I'd be thinking like, oh, yeah, see, they're lying about something and who knows what they're up to and blah, 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 that type of thing. All you're saying is he gave them the change back at the McDonald's, like, and all this was just to set up an, why not tell him, beat it? Nah, you can't go with me. I got other things to do to set up my trip. I'll bring you something back. He could have just said that, right? Who's Cato Kalin? I'm O.J. Simpson. Get out of here, right? Number four, Alan Park, limo driver. He drove up Rockingham at about 10:25 p.m., and this was crucial. Simpson's Bronco was not there. The O.J. case involves a great deal of so-called eyewitness testimony. This aspect brought to mind a book I read a few years ago, Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error by suspected racist Catherine Schultz. One of the interesting assertions in the book is that eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable in criminal cases, but still emphasized it to juries. This is known by both lawyers, prosecutors, and defense, but they still emphasize it to juries. Chapter 18, The Best Trial Lawyer. Number 1, Hang Fung Restaurant reminds me of calling COVID-19 the Kung Flu. Good one. Number 2, Blood on the Gate contained EDTA, a preservative used in the test tube. This seems like an extremely important piece of evidence. How else do you explain it except that the blood is planted or LAPD is guilty of the most egregious incompetence? Tell me something. Number 3, news video showing Fung placing the vial in his truck outside OJ's house. Thus, that blood couldn't have been planted at Nicole's condo on Monday. I am not sure how this eliminates the possibility that the blood could not have been planted. Why couldn't the vial first be transported to Bundy, Nicole's residence, before being taken to OJ's house? Number four, Fung's pitiful appearance serves as the best argument that he was no conspirator. Tubin is very consistent in denigrating non-white victims throughout. Number five, Nicole Brown Simpson's charitable foundation, the first president Jeff C. Nobel, savings and loan scam, and domestic violence. The list of racist suspects of questionable ethics just goes on and on and on. Indeed. 19. Stockholm Syndrome. Number one, it was probably a freelance effort by an insider to help Simpson's cause or a part of a personal vendetta. Oh, we didn't get that far. Oh, my goodness. We have to get to some of the other witnesses. Man, Tubin, all I can say is, man, like, if you read any of the other books, the only conclusion that you can come to, Tubin's book doesn't have footnotes either. That's something that I commented on repeatedly as we read Case and other books. No footnotes to verify where he's getting this information from. If you watch the trial or read any other books, you would conclude pretty quickly Jeffrey Tubin is lying repeatedly in this book. You have some sort of other agenda, but it is not to reveal truth about what happened in this case. It's even contradicted repeatedly by things that are in the prosecution's book, and he seems to at least be on the same page. O.J. Simpson did it. He got away with murder. That no good, dirty, rah, rah, rah. And he's even contradicted. Anyway, we'll get to more of that as we continue. Let's see. We'll start. Retired firefighter in Florida. We didn't get to him at all first time around. Did you have commentary, sir? You should be with us.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the guests. Yes, my commentary would just be on the advent of a white male stating about the lack of intelligence that black people have, and up comes this white male racist who didn't even graduate from high school. I am quite used to that contradiction, because similar to police departments, the fire department is basically the same also, basically after World War II, there was a lot of black parents who encouraged their children to go to college. And I'm a part of that generation, the Tuskegee pilots, most of those guys were college graduates, college students, that sort of thing, comparable to the white males who were in the Army Air Corps at the time that did not go to college at all. Also from the standpoint that if O.J. was that dumb, how come O.J. still has millions of dollars, you know, today? He was pretty good at organizing that legal team that was going to fight on his behalf, and a lot of things that he did correctly, to whereas he still has a lot of money, more than a lot of white people still today. Otherwise, he wouldn't have it, because he certainly doesn't have it because white people like him so much. I was just thinking about those things, and, you know, and white people on those jobs, like the police department and fire department, they cheat on all of those tests big time, entry level promotions, especially during that time when things were on paper. And I'm pretty sure they got methods and tactics to whereas now they still, in a viral sense, able to cheat on tests as far as entry level and promotions, as far as that's concerned. So that kind of like debunks all of that that rhetoric that I was used to hearing while I was on that job that I was on. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. White welfare. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, we'll make sure you can share before we conclude. Just wanted to make sure that I got in. Alan Park, the limo driver. Tubin talked about how he had such devastating, incriminating testimony. When we get to the end, pay attention when he gets to the jury deliberation. And even, in fact, there's two important points. Alan Park, if you're going to, like, watch, if you want to jump around and watch different parts of the trial, certainly watch Mark Furman both times he testifies. But Alan Park's testimony is very important. Marsha Clark mentions Alan Park's testimony in her closing argument. One thing, this trial, man, it is about precision in a courtroom, like words, exactly what you say. Sometimes it's huge consequences just based on what you say, what you don't say, what words you use. That comes up repeatedly in this trial. Even F. Lee Bailey, when Mark Furman says, "You don't, well, I don't recall." He says, "Wait a minute. Are you saying that maybe you called someone a nigger and you just don't remember it? Or are you saying that you didn't do it at all?" Because that's a distinction. Like, it is about precision in the courtroom. Marsha Clark, and I will add many others, when they get to talking about the butcher of Brentwood or Renthal James killed these white people, frequently they will misrepresent Alan Park's testimony. This happens so frequently that it would lead me to believe this could be a collective effort at deception. They didn't just have Alan Park in a courtroom say, "Well, where did you see Mr. Simpson? You know, did you see him walking up the driveway? Did you have him get a knife?" No, 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 no. They got a layout, right, of what the Simpson estate at Rockingham looks like. They put a clicker in Alan Park's hand. Whammo. Put the X on where you saw Mr. Simpson. Now we're not going to have any guesswork about, did you see him down at the gate? Did you see him here? He put the clicker, the X, approximately 10 feet from the front door. That is a substantial difference. Like, we're talking yards and yards from either of the gates at the Simpson property. So it would not have been, "I saw him re-entering the gate. I didn't see him running from around the back of the property," where he said he saw Cato with a flashlight. He saw him about 10 feet from the front door, which would sadly coincide with exactly what Mr. Simpson said he did. Limo's here. He went outside and started putting his bags down. He went back in the house, got on the intercom. "Hey, I'm ready to go. I already slammed. Blah, blah, blah. Let's go." It would match up exactly with what he said. When you listen to Marsha Clark, she misrepresents Alan Park's testimony at the end, and then the ignorant, no-count, lame, uneducated black jury, their memory works so well, they remembered Alan Park's testimony and pointed out Marsha Clark is wrong. At minimum, either she's in error and her memory is bad, or she lied to us. Pick one. They only reviewed one bit of testimony. When all this is done, the jury, the one bit of testimony that they listened to again was Alan Park. And once they went back and confirmed, yes, it was, and my memory is correct, it was 10-2. That was the initial vote, 10 for acquittal, 2 for guilty. The 2 for guilty were wrong in their recollection of what Alan Park's testimony was. The 10 that voted for guilty, they were correct in what their memory was. They said, "Let's go to the transcript. Let's see what he said." They went and listened. As soon as it was confirmed, the people who were voting not guilty were correct, they got up and started to leave. They went back and voted again. 12, unanimous, not guilty. Trial is over. Alan Park's testimony is huge. And if you pay attention, people consistently, you can pick one. Either they're consistently misrepresenting his testimony or they're deliberately lying. Pick one. But pay attention to where he says, and then when other people talk about his testimony, where are they locating Mr. Simpson? Is it at the driveway? Is it at the fence? Is it at the gate? Or is it what he said? And again, they put a clicker in his hand. X on the spot where you saw Mr. Simpson. It was approximately 10 feet from the front door.
Other folks, did you have any comments you wanted to get in our overtime with Orenthal James Simpson, who just got his Rona inoculation? They were mad about that, too. They had that in the Las Vegas Review. They were piping hot. O.J. Simpson going to get online and taunt us. No Rona for him. What kind of world is this? Other folks have commentary? Folks satisfied? Assume folks might be good to go. Did a little extra OT for the section today. I'm going to double check to make sure there was nothing more. They had the reference to the Bad Boys film, Will Smith, Martin Lawrence. They've made, I think they just made another one of those terrible movies. Again, The Man, not Bad Boys, and that's black people, you know, bad, even though they are the good guys in the movie. They are the police officers, Will Smith and Martin Lawrence, but even then, they're not heroic figures. They are bad boys, much like O.J. Simpson. And he even brings that up to say that that's Johnny Cochran playing the race card again. Oh, good movie, good movie. Curry a little favor with the Negroes. Yes, that's a great Negro flick there, the great Will Smith. Let's see. Anything else I wanted to get in? Just the continued talk about the jurors, I think, is so important. These folks got $5 per day. I'm not even sure if that includes weekends. $5 a day. You are sequestered. You don't get to see your family, friends, none of that. You don't get to go out, hang out. No phone, no Wi-Fi. You can't watch television, no TV in your room. You have to go out and watch in a group like they said. Can you imagine that for 10 months? They even had some of the jurors, they talked about you get conjugal visits. They said that it was so degrading. You only got conjugal visits once a week. So whoever your wife or your significant other partner, they're coming in and they know what it's for. So everyone's looking at you. Like, are you serious? Like, that's what you're being subject for $5 a day. You can't work during all of this. So the financial hardship for a lot of people for 10 months, you can't work, can't see it. Some people had children. Can you imagine being a parent and you can't see your offspring for 10 months? You get $5 a day and then to sit around and be ridiculed as dumb and ignorant for a quarter century. And racist, dumb, ignorant, and racist. And since they talk about most of this jury as being a predominantly black jury or an all black jury, I'm not sure. Do we have, is this the first instance of honorary black jurors? Because there actually were two white women on the jury and one non-white, non-black person. So we might actually have honorary black people, in quotes, on the jury. I just say that they're all ignorant and dumb and stupid black people. I would not have done it. I don't care how much you think black people love O.J. Simpson or anybody else. There is no one in the world I would tolerate that. So I wouldn't even be able to broadcast the cows like in that sort of environment. There is no way in the world anybody would do that for $5 a day. To have masturbating Jeff Toobin write a book and talk bad about you that becomes a bestseller where they can mock you in a TV program. Yes. We will wrap there. Folks are good.
Gus, do you think that this could even happen today? That you could sequester people, take away their phones and internet and, because none of that stuff existed yet. Like I don't even think that you can have a trial where the jury can't be influenced by outside forces. So this jury wasn't able to watch all the news already saying OJ's guilty every night. They were kept away from that. But in today's time, they'll be influenced by all of that, you know, propaganda and stuff. So it's very interesting.
The Bill Cosby jury was sequestered The Trayvon murder trial, that jury was sequestered. It does happen. Now, the question is still the same as it was in this trial. Does it work? Because they said, you know, folks in this trial, that they still got information about the Furman tapes and, you know, other things from conjugal visits or phone calls, because they're only monitored one way. Like, allegedly they don't have someone actually on the line listening. They just have someone sitting next to the juror, so they can only hear what that person is saying. They can't hear what the person on the phone is saying, allegedly. But yes, they still do it. They take your phone, they take your computer, laptop, or whatever it is. They take the TV out of your room. It, you know, works the same way that it did. The question, as I said, is just, does it work? It seems that doing all that, you still don't really miss out on everything. I think even with this jury, they took them out for that field. He skipped over that. They took them out for the field trip to OJ's house, and everybody saw that. That was like a big media event. It was like a parade. They had so many police and escorts going with them to do all this, and people have signs up and free OJ t-shirts and all the rest of it. So there's a lot. Even I think Alan Dershowitz and others wrote about, you know, is this effective? Does it work? Does it even, you know, keep all that, the propaganda and media away from you during that time? But effectiveness or no, yes, they still do it. I don't know if the Bill Cosby trial is the most recent trial where the jury was sequestered, but Trayvon Martin murder trial, Bill Cosby, yes, they do still sequester juries, and it still sucks.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter.
Yes, the only thing I can think about on why jury was so committed is because of the knowledge of who was the defendant, Orenthal James Simpson, and I'm telling you that the. Of course, his lawyers were very smart, especially Johnny Cochran and F. Lee Bailey, on selecting that jury, knowing that, as you mentioned before, I wouldn't have done it, that's for sure, you know, even back during that time, let alone talking about today, but, just think about the thousands of people who had stopped their cars on the expressway when he was in that white SUV. You know what I mean? He was of that magnitude as far as in the eyes of a whole lot of black people. And that's the only thing I can figure out on why they would that black people would be that disciplined to spend that kind of time to be a part of this this court proceeding, and in turn render him not guilty because of his, I don't know if I'm using the right word, his aura in itself, you know, that was projected primarily from being on television and being in movies and being O.J. Simpson. He had that kind of charisma.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Many folks, you know, said something similar in terms of the sentiment connection that some of the black jurors had to OJ. They said one of the dismissed jurors actually met OJ Simpson and was a Hertz employee, but the jury was not all black. So I'm not sure if that OJ charisma, if that impacted again, as I just said, maybe we had honorary black people, maybe them hanging out in the hotel with the black people for so long, maybe they became honorary black and they were subject to the same wooing by Mr. Simpson over this near year period. But the entire jury was not black, so some non-black people had to co-sign on this for us to get to the acquittal at the end. But we shall see. Folks satisfied? Anything else? Grand, did our overtime. Hopefully it was worthy of folks Thursday evening. Know it is late for folks on the East Coast. Whew, glad I'm not out there. We will be here tomorrow neutralizing workplace racism. We will tune in normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll check in
Black History Month, man, I know it's all kinds of tackiness. Maybe some of that's minimized because of the Rona, but this is normally time where a lot of workplaces, they turn up and it gets really tacky for this time of year. It'll be Watermelon Day, Fried Chicken Day, that type of thing. So just endure for the next 28 days and it'll be spring before we know it. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We will need our brain computer to solve the problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled. If we're going to go out, I still say let's hunker down, be discreet. If we are going to go out, it is lots of armed whites ready to do battle. Kyle Rittenhouse was on the loose just a few hours ago. Be very alert if you're going to be out and about. If you see any white people, GED or no, badge or no, who are being loud, rowdy, hostile, no verbal engagement, get out of there. Get to a safe place. If you need to call enforcement officials, you can do that as you're exiting. But no confrontations with random folks, white or non-white. It is way too dangerous to be taking those sort of chances in this environment. All of that said, we are sober. If you're going out, you're buckled and alert. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone, just trying to minimize contact with the Mark GED Furmans of the known universe, doing the small things, being buckled, being sober, not on the cell phone, little things that we can't control. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Yeah. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned. Yeah.